in 2000. We know Al Gore won Florida. And if you want evidence, I'll be happy to give you the song and dance. I've done this many times on the show. Even Matt Drudge admits it's true. Congress admitted it. Everyone has said it's true. In 2004, they denied the vote to enough African Americans that they couldn't vote. And the whole trick in understanding the U.S. attorney scandal is understanding it's all about trying to keep blacks and the Democrats from voting. That's it for the Inside Scoop today.
This is the Quality News Network. Four cities will get a boost in crime fighting. The Justice Department announced teams of federal agents are being dispatched to Mesa, Arizona, Orlando, Florida, San Bernardino, California, and San Juan, Puerto Rico. The enforcement comes as the FBI is releasing a report indicating that violent crime is on the rise nationally. More Americans are working. U.S. employers added 157,000 jobs in May, and the unemployment rate held steady at 4.5%. The employment report suggests that despite the nation's sluggish economic growth, companies are still hiring. Wearing his trademark cardigan, the man known as Dr. Death walked out of prison today. After 8 years behind bars, Jack Kevorkian claims that he assisted in 130 suicides. Kevorkian promised never to participate in another suicide. The attorney with an untreatable form of tuberculosis said he has proof. Doctors told him he was not at risk to others. Andrew Speaker said his father taped the conversation with health officials. Fulton County, Georgia health officials say they have no knowledge of a recording. The most important White House insider is preparing to leave the Bush administration. Dan Bartlett, one of the president's most trusted advisors and longest-serving aides, is stepping down. Bartlett said he's been thinking about leaving for several months because he wants to spend more time with his three young children. U.S. Attorney Tim Griffin has said he is also stepping down as the top federal prosecutor in Arkansas. Griffin replaced one of the nine attorneys who were fired amid controversy last year. Heavy fighting at a Palestinian refugee camp near Tripoli. Lebanese troops overran positions held by Al-Qaeda-inspired militants. 18 people were killed in the battle. Nearly 100 people have died since the fighting began in the refugee camp on May 20th. The Sudanese government is retaliating against the U.S. for imposing sanctions. Sudan's U.S. ambassador threatened to cut off exports of gum arabica, a main ingredient in soda. The ambassador denied government-funded militias that are killing civilians in Darfur. In Venezuela, demonstrations continue across the country protesting President Hugo Chavez's takeover of the country's premier TV station. In the past days, one person was killed and hundreds injured as Venezuelan troops beat protesters in the streets.
To be or not to be.
Proficiency in reading and writing is a crucial connection to higher learning for both youth and adults. Without the foundation of basic English skills, access to education and employment is severely limited, if not impossible, for an estimated 40 million illiterate and semi-literate adults nationwide. If someone you know needs help in learning to read and write, there are local groups that can provide assistance without the threat of embarrassment. The Monterey County Free Library System offers unlimited one-on-one classes meant to help anyone at any proficiency level step over the language barrier. Weekly classes are held at several free library locations across Monterey County at no charge. For more information on Monterey County Free Library's Adult Literacy Program, call 424-3564. This message brought to you by the Quality News Network.
A melon thought to be over 2,000 years old has been unearthed southwest of Tokyo. Archaeologists think the fruit was well preserved because it was in a vacuum-packed state in a wet layer below the ground. The Georgia Aquarium in downtown Atlanta has two new whale sharks. Both males, the whale sharks arrived from Taiwan on a cargo plane with huge fiberglass tanks. NASA announced repairs to the space shuttle have been completed and they are go for launch next week. Walmart will reduce the number of planned superstore openings in the U.S. by 25%. Walmart CEO Lee Scott says the retail giant will focus on existing stores. Still, Walmart plans to open up to 200 supercenters in 2008. Dow Jones & Company has been put up for sale. Word is that Rupert Murdoch is interested in buying the company for $5 billion. California announced it expects a record almond harvest this year, a 17% increase over last year's 1.12 billion pounds. Light sweet crude oil is trading at $65.08 a barrel, and at the close of Wall Street today, more record-breaking numbers. The Dow Jones was up 40 points at 13,668, the NASDAQ was up 9 points, and the S&P 500 up 6 points. There's more on our website at qualitynewsnetwork.com. I'm Claudia Eisman. Now this.
Now, Head On with Bob Kincaid. Head On is brought to you every night by the West Virginia District Council of Carpenters and Millwrights. Union Carpenters and Millwrights, they're building the American dream. Free speech isn't free if you don't use it. So call Bob now at 1-877-4-HEAD-ON. That's 1-877-443-2366. Now, here's Bob Kincaid on the Head On Radio Network.
Well, howdy! Woohoo! Friday! Who am I kidding? It just means 2 days of silence. Right? Yep, 2 days of silence, 2 days of muddling through. But we will. And until then, we've got slightly less than 3 hours to get it all off our chest, out from the burr out from under the saddle, the bee out from under the bonnet, and enter the weekend with something approaching a modicum of mental health. Right. So that's what we're going to do this evening, or at least I hope so. I've got several stories I want to get to this evening. And hope I do. Of course, I say that a lot of the time and never get to them because I get, you know, I've got adult onset attention deficit disorder or something because I'm much more interested in talking with you guys than I am just sitting here blathering away. But last night we started with a letter from Private Donald Hudson. You remember that? It was at Clarksville Online, Clarksville, Tennessee. Well, I got another one for you this evening. From a young man by the name of Milo Freeman, age 24, gender male, astrological sign Aries, zodiac year boar, industry military. Boy, doesn't that say a mouthful? Industry military. Location Iraq. About me, American soldier, 24 years old and writing from the sand, missing a wife back home, finding it hard to square up what I see against the news stories. See the disclaimer below. When you've got water stuck in your ear, how do you get out? Two words, cordless drill. Interests, I think this would be a good, nice young man to know. Interests, reading, writing, rambling discussions over strong coffee or beer. The disclaimer that he notes below isn't. But he's got a blog. The name of the blog is The Calm Before the Sand for the Hearts You Break Every Time You Moan. This is his blog posting from May the 25th, 2007. And you know, we saw the thing in the Clarksville Online last night, and there's this. And I wonder if after the military announced that they were cracking down on the ability of soldiers to be heard, if there hasn't been a bit of a flurry to get some last comments out there before the big darkness comes. Now, okay, sorry, but there are some questionable words in here, so, you know, hide the babies and, you know, whatever. Although I promise a word won't hurt them. If I said I was going to come running into the room with a hammer, hide the babies. These words will not hurt them. This is just reality. And unfortunately, we live in a censorship society where it's more where reality is less important than making sure that certain words don't get said. But this is the internet. And as long as the situation is such that I don't have to deal with FCC regulations, I won't. The name of the blog post, If the Shoe Fits, date 25/05/2007, memorandum for record, military spending concerns from Specialist Freeman, Milo, U.S. Army, Iraq. 2. Senate Democrats, Republicans, and American Idol viewers across the nation. 1. You punk-ass, panty-wasted bitches. 2. You had a chance. You could have put your money where your mouth is. Could have put some ass behind all those claims of favoring an end to war. 3. And you fucking choked. 4. Let me explain something to you. Your children, your spouses, your lovers and friends and parents and constituents are hostages to this war. They're dying for a conflict with no concrete objective. They're losing marriages and childhood moments to a never-ending cycle of extended tours. Their equipment, their morale is stretched thin, and some of them, those of us smart enough not to buy the fucking hype, were counting on you to find your fucking testicles and put an end to this shit. We were counting on you to save us from ourselves, to find a way to put us to use, serving our country in ways perhaps more effective in rebuilding our nation. And you fucking choked. Okie dokie? Yeah. I'd like to read you the rest of it, but my computer just locked up. This is getting very frustrating. Very, very, very frustrating. Nope, it's locked up. Okay, I'm not a prima donna. I am not a diva. But I am one hair on a baboon's butt away from mailing it in tonight. This just chaps my butt. No, it won't be. So, here, let me hit the magic button. Try to restart this little maggot machine. You can't find it, Agnes. No, honey. Okay. You can't find it. But that's kind of enough, isn't it? I think Specialist Freeman made his point, didn't he? Oh, I hope they haven't seen this at Pentagon headquarters. Why, they'll get their fancy little general costumes all soiled, thinking that the people actually doing the fighting are finally beginning to speak up. Don't you think? I looked and I wish my memory was just slightly more photographic. Okay, I'm told that a caller has the rest of it. Raydeen, are you there?
Bob.
Yeah.
Where were you?
I think I got to 0.5.
Oh, okay. And you fucking choked. That's where we go. I didn't think you'd do this. I posted it a couple days ago. I'll go ahead with the next one. 6. I haven't gotten a current edition of the paper in months. It's always a day behind. I don't get to check the news. I barely have the time. So what am I to think when I read yesterday's Stars and Stripes and hear about this shit? Is that supposed to tell me that my leaders, my countrymen, give a flying fuck about what happens to me or my wife? Is that the message I'm supposed to glean from this stunning lack of cojones? Because I gotta tell you, America, I'm not seeing it. 7. I'm so sick of hearing this wretched war talked about in terms of victory or defeat. If we leave, the terrorists will win. 8. Fuck that. 2009. Today it's terrorists. Yesterday it was blacks, gays, Jews, hippies. Before that it was communists. Before that it was uppity colonials with secondhand muskets and pitchforks. It's always fucking something with you people, isn't it? 10. You just need your little wars to feel good about yourselves, don't you? Something to make you feel threatened. Something to make you feel heroic. Anything to make you feel like your pathetic lives are more than just you against the big, black, scary infinite. Huh. Well, obviously, it's working. 11. You don't magically win an occupation. It's an inevitable bleed out. We're stuck in a situation beyond our powers to fix in a country that we voted to destroy, whose history and people we neither understand nor care to try. We bought the hype. Hook, line, and sinker. 12. Fuck victory. Fuck defeat. Any way you slice it, this war is wrong. Period. 13. You don't keep trying to win the game after it turns out you bribed the refs. You fire the coaches and or players responsible and you hand over the title. You take your lumps like a fucking man and try to rebuild. Accept it. Hope you're happy, America. Clutch your pearls about all those dirty liberals who voted against the proposal. They didn't support the troops. Whine about all the evil elderly school teachers and librarians protesting the war on a Saturday morning outside your courthouse. 14. But when your son or daughter or spouse or first lay comes home air freight, mangled into a closed casket service by a daisy chain of 155s buried under Route Tampa, remember this. 15. It won't be the dirty liberal who put them there. 16. Hoo-ah!
Yeah, I love the hoo-ah part.
Original signed, Milo Freeman.
Raydeen, I read these things, and I have become a skeptic in my old age. You think this is real?
I do. I went through the rest of this blog, and other than not seeing too much from his wife, who's also posted here, I really do think it is. I think he's one that's gotten around the MySpace ban, etc.
Well, I think we're going to hear, if we are allowed, and of course, for some reason or another, the foreign press is a lot more competent, it would seem, than the domestic press is at giving soldiers their say. And then again, you go to Stars and Stripes, and I don't go there nearly as often as I should, Raydeen, but when you do, you find this stuff without the F words.
Yeah, they clean it up a little.
Yeah.
Something here amazing I heard today at LiveLeak.com was an anti-recruiting message, basically, from a guy that's there now. And it's really good, too. I'll put up that link in a bit. It's a little
good.
Bit of good audio.
Yeah, do please. I'm separated. I don't talk to a lot of wingnuts anymore. It's kind of deliberate on my part. What do you suppose goes through what passes for their minds when and if they see something like Milo's work?
Oh, it's hard. I basically cut off the couple that I dealt with every day who has a son in that's a medic there because I couldn't even communicate with them anymore about a year ago. They were the main ones that I tried to. And I keep hoping he's a non-vet. He was dealt with horribly. I keep hoping somehow he'll get beyond the mind washing, whatever, brainwashing. But he hasn't yet.
Well, it just—I'd love to tie Rush Limbaugh to a chair and make him listen to this.
Exactly.
Because he's very well. You know, we know what a hypocrisy support the troops is. Support the troops. When you get to the end of the day, is support Bush. That's what they mean.
That's what they mean.
You know, one of the things that just drives me absolutely crazy because right before the electric computer machine crashed. it's so frustrating.
Sorry.
I've got another story up here that I ran across. I found it over at BuzzFlash this morning while I was producing.
Mm-hmm.
Have you seen this story of the grieving mothers who met with Bush?
Oh, no.
This is a new group of grieving mothers.
Somebody else is still trying?
Yeah. And he gave them presidential coins.
Oh, okay. I barely saw a reference to that in the chat. I didn't look at it.
Yeah, it's a real screamer rating.
That's basically what Peter said.
He meets these people, these mothers, and, you know, and here is a presidential coin. And I kid you not. Here's your presidential coin. Now, don't go auctioning it on eBay. You know, and I don't know. There are people out there that are just so much better human beings than I am, because I don't think I could get past one of those without at least kicking a shin.
Yeah, I'd grab one of his hairs, something, and burn it with ritual later.
I mean, can you imagine? Because this mother has just looked at him. If you go find the story, this mother has just looked
Which
at him
one
and
is
said,
it called?
"Why?
Do you remember?
No, it was at BuzzFlash.
Okay."
But the eBay line is in the link. You'll see it there. The mother has looked at him and said, "Why did my son die?" And his very facile answer was, "To complete a mission." And she said, "Okay, what's the mission?"
Oh.
At which point he just sort of looked at her like a cow looking at a new gate. And then began handing out the coins.
I wish he would have run into it first.
It's too much. It's too much, Raydeen.
Absolutely.
We had the account yesterday out of the Dallas Morning News, for heaven's sakes, pointing up the fact that this man has gone just crazier than an outhouse rat.
Yeah.
You know, ranting and
president. I'm the president.
I'm the decider. They don't understand me. Yeah, and this is the kind of stuff that you get when you get the family together and do an intervention on a crackhead.
Right. This is the stuff that I could not understand how could happen to people like Johnson, people like Nixon, the people that were here before me this time around.
So I'm flabbergasted. There's a constitutional provision, Raydeen, that says upon the incapacity of the president, you know, no high crimes, no misdemeanors, no impeachment, but that there's a mechanism that's triggered upon the incapacity of the president.
Right.
If the guy is standing in the middle of the room raving, then maybe it's time to start talking about it. And you know what? Sure, we get Dick Cheney, but you know what? We can impeach his ass.
He's a lot easier to get through because he wasn't directly elected, even for the rest of everybody.
But he's also central to the whole process.
Yes. He is the kingpin as far as I can tell.
And so, you know, I'll take that. I said last night that I've got this creepy feeling going on. Mm-hmm. You know, something wicked this way comes. And
it's hard to go there when it's been so bad already.
Yeah, I know. You know, 157,000 new jobs created today. Yeah, and this goes out over the news. Bless their hearts, the folks at QNN, whatever. And that's the news that's put out. But the news will not go out nearly as loudly next month when you get the inevitable story that the Labor Department today downgraded its figures for job creation in the month of April.
Right.
And instead of 157,000, it's 100,000. You know. Yeah, it is frustrating, and it's tough, and it's painful. So, as frustrating as it is for us, I think hearing something from something like Specialist Freeman really puts it contextualizes it for us, doesn't it?
Oh yeah, I just had to make sure the rest of the words got out there since you started it. So
well, I appreciate it, Raydeen.
I have me the chance.
Oh, it's my pleasure, and I'm so glad you were ready at the draw there. you pulled mine out of the fire this time, and I appreciate it.
Well, I kept you from pulling the plug for the night anyway.
Yeah, you did. Thanks, Raydeen.
You're welcome.
Bye bye.
Have a great weekend.
You too. Okay, I've got the little machine box up again. Maybe it'll stay up this time. And let me just see again. I'm trying to be a good talk radio host, trying to be green, trying to not use all the paper up. But this story about the mothers meeting with Dear Leader is. I can't tell you exactly what it's like because we come in here and we start producing shows, and I don't intrude upon other hosts' programs. You know, I don't open the mic here and yammer on. I've got a little show. I'll do it. They'll do theirs. But I'm also doing prep-type stuff for the program as I produce. Or I'm sitting here next to Agnes and she's producing. And I'm glad the mic's not open because that would mean the screaming would become obvious. And I can't bear that. It's too much. And it just... by the way, this I found it at BuzzFlash... but it was published in the Chicago Tribune, The Swamp, the Chicago Tribune's Washington Bureau. Specialist Freeman's blog is also available from the network website. You can go there and read it for yourself now. Thanks to our news ninja, Susan. This is what I was talking with Ray Dean about. Several mothers who have lost children at war in Iraq took part in a new talk show on National Public Radio recently. One of them, Elaine Johnson, recounted a meeting that she had with President Bush in which he gave her a presidential coin and told her and five other families, don't go sell it on eBay. I mean, it's a presidential coin. It doesn't have any monetary value. What is it? Just let that happen to you for a minute. What does that mean? He gets together and he gives them a coin that has no worth and tells them not to sell it on eBay. The president told her, this is an excerpt from NPR's Tell Me More. The president told her that the war goes on because the U.S., quote, has a mission to complete. The host there, Michael Martin, asked Ms. Johnson, what about you? Why did you decide to start speaking out? She said, quote, my son was killed November 2nd, 2003. After they had my son's memorial in Colorado Springs, that's Fort Carson, I was interviewed by the Gazette newspaper, and that started it all. They said they had a mother or person ever lashed out at the president, criticized the president of being insensitive. So a couple of days after they had called me and said that President Bush would like to meet me. And I said, well, okay, only at his cost because I was not spending my money to meet him. So he flew about 100 families back to Fort Carson. And in the room that I was in, it was only me and four more other families, and I asked him questions, you know, why were we over there? Couldn't answer that. I said, well, what are we fighting for? He said, to finish a mission. I said, why was my son and the rest of the soldiers on the Chinook helicopter, which was supposed to only transport cargoes and not humans? He said, well, he didn't know. He referred me to General Wilson, who was in the same room. General Wilson's response was that they, you know, they was transporting them on that same helicopter and never was shot down. They flew over Fallujah. Fallujah was always the hot spot. Common sense would have told them, if you fly over Fallujah, you should have escorts that have the equipment to detect these weapons that would attack the thing. But, you know, they're so brilliant. They're up there in D.C. Now that a mother with a high school diploma can sit down and say, okay, now I won't send them over a hot spot without protection. Bush, he just didn't see that, and he told me I was kind of, seemed like I was kind of hostile. I said, yes, I am hostile because you sent my son over there. So my thing is, all the questions that I asked him, he didn't know nothing then, and he definitely don't know nothing now, because the United States is in worse shape now than it was in 2003 that my son died. Martin asked, so when you left that meeting, did you leave with determination to do something, or did that happen over time? Johnson said, when he told me I said, what's the mission? He couldn't give me an answer. I says, well, I'm going to tell you what. I'm on my mission now. My mission has just begun, and my mission is to fight to bring these troops home, to take care of these troops when they get home. Then he gave us a presidential coin. She said, now you check this out. He gave six of us a presidential coin. Tell us not to tell the rest of the people that was there. And then after that, he told us, don't go sell it on eBay. Now you tell me how insensitive that can be. What kind of caring person is that? Whew, mother. It sounds, you know, we, of course, our vacillating lapdog press wouldn't dare report something like that when it happened. Remember, this was some years ago. There is an element of complicity in the American so-called professional media that is almost impossible to calculate. Judith Miller and her crowd at the New York Times rah-rahed this war into existence. You know, if it was ever possible to find out, I would not be in the least bit surprised to find out that Judith Miller was actually on the CIA payroll. Jesus, they wanted this war, didn't they? God, they wanted it worse than I wanted a bicycle when I was six, and I wanted one bad. And it's about the same level, too, isn't it? They wanted this war like a child wants a toy. And what a price we're paying. A coin. A presidential coin. A room full of people and six grieving, heartbroken, destroyed mothers, the fruits of whose wombs are in the dirt, dead, gone, long before they should have been. And he hands them a coin and says, "And hey, don't go auctioning, it's on eBay." That is insane. That is evil. That is, to quote our good friend Dr. Rick, that is sociopathic. That is a fundamental inability to connect with the very basic nature of being human. And it's where we are. And we're going to take a break. I'm going to try to recover my other stories. When we get back, your phone calls are welcome. Or I'll babble. You pick. Phone number, of course, you already know, 877-443-2366. 877, the numeral 4, head on. That's the toll-free number. Or on your own nickel, 304-658-5453. Makes no difference to me. Email rolls in to bob@headonradio.com. We'll be back. You're listening to America's liberal voice. You're listening to The Horn. I'm Bob Kincaid.
The founding fathers, they had pride. It wasn't perfect, they fought and died. 200 years of struggle for equality. Now we look more like a monarchy. The halls where justice did once reside has been sold out and replaced with lies. It's all money, power to the few. How long until they come for you? And you say that it can never.
Sweetie, I love you, but those jeans have got to go.
Yeah, I know. Grab me a pair next time you go to the store, would you?
No.
Huh?
I'm not going there anymore. I can't stand it.
What do you mean?
It's just awful, honey. The only smile in that building is that big yellow face. Everybody else looks miserable, and I can't find anything there that's made in our country. That bothers me.
Well, nobody makes clothes in America anymore.
Au contraire, mi amigo. There's a ton of American-made clothing at No Sweat.
Well, where's this No Sweat store? Out at the mall?
No, silly. I found them at HeadOnRadioNetwork.com. There's a link there. I already ordered some great workout gear, and I also got you some new jeans. They'll be here in a couple of days. Surprise. surprise.
HeadOnRadioNetwork.com?
Uh-huh. Just click on the No Sweat banner. You're right there. Helps union workers and helps support America's other liberal network. Cool, huh?
I knew listening to the horn was a good idea.
Whose idea?
Your idea, dear. All the good ones are.
Union made? No sweat. Great prices? No sweat. Great looks? No sweat. No sweat at HeadOnRadioNetwork.com. Click the banner. Do the right thing.
This is the Head On Radio Network. The Horn.
Yeah, my name is Billy Shears.
This is Billy Shears. Join me every Friday at 11 a.m. Eastern on Boxed Up with John Fox. Each week, I'll feature an artist and a song with a little commentary. We'll examine why music plays such an important role in our social and political climate. We'll try and make it fun, informative, and entertaining. Join us every Friday at 11 a.m. Eastern, right here on the Head On Radio Network, The Horn, with John Fox on Foxed Up. And for music with political commentary by great liberal minds, check out my website at unreportednews.net. This is Billy Shears, and hey, thanks for lending an ear.
And what is it about the right-wingers that they can't hear what we're saying? We're not going anywhere. We will have the right to marry. We will serve openly in the military. And we will not be your damn victims. What? Can't you understand English?
She's a woman in a text of us. A song.
Lightning only takes an instant. An instant that could end your life or injure you for life. Don't let it end your playing days on the field. Remember, you are in danger from lightning if you can hear thunder. Learn more about lightning safety at www.lightningsafety.noaa.gov. Lightning kills. Play it safe. This message is brought to you by the Iowa High School Athletic Association and your local National Weather Service office.
In this dirty old part of the city, where the sun refused to shine, people tell me there ain't no use in trying. Now, my girl, you're so young and pretty. One thing I know is true. You'll be dead before your time is due. I know. Watch my daddy in bed and crying. Watch his habits turn greater. He's been working and slaving his life away. Oh, yes, I know.
That better life may not necessarily include a functioning computer. I'm sorry, I don't mean to sound whiny. It's amazing. I think we bought our first computer in 1995. I don't mean like for the radio show, but I know that we got the first. It was a Packard Hell, a Pentium 1. That was the beginning of it, and you know, it really the computer culture really has wormed its way into our existence, hasn't it? It is vitally important here, and boy, we've had a tough run of luck with the little monsters lately. I don't know how many times you can restart it, but I keep restarting, starting up. It keeps locking up. Oh, Lord, it's frustrating, isn't it? And, you know, I mean, this is not to say that I can't sit here and filibobster for 2.5 hours. I can. But just, you know, there's a minimal standard of what you like in the way of things actually working. I've got a pretty good memory, and frankly, I can recall most of them, but I don't know. There's an old saying out there from a juggler or something that said, if you drop something, make it look like part of the act. This is Honesty Central. Suddenly things are not going quite so perfectly, and this is part of that. And it's incredibly frustrating. Because a lot of times for Fridays, I save stories that we haven't gotten to through the course of the week that I feel like are still deserving of attention. And I tell you what, this is a very frustrating situation. We're gonna take a break. I'm just trying to let you know what's going on here. We're gonna take a break, an extended break. We'll play some music or something. And I'm gonna try to get this thing going so that we can have something approaching a normal broadcast. Because right now it's almost too frustrating to function. So Agnes, you know, start a nice long song if you wouldn't mind, please. We'll play a couple if we have to. I'm going to make this thing go. I'm sorry, folks. I'm truly sorry.
We'll get it there. Just hold on.
But, you know, it's not for want of trying. We will be back. This is the Head On Radio Network. I'm Bob Kincaid.
Listening to WIN, Workers Independent News. I'm Doug Cunningham. Unite Here Canada Director Alex Dagg says a distribution center serving American Eagle Outfitters is violating Canadian labor law in an organizing campaign at the facility in Ontario. So Unite Here is launching a public campaign targeting American Eagle Outfitters in an effort to stop the anti-union actions of National Logistics Services, the company that bought the distribution center from American Eagle Outfitters.
We have gone to almost every single store here in the province of Ontario. There are almost 40 stores here. And we're launching a North American-wide campaign where we will be doing days of action against the American Eagle stores in the next 4 to 5 days in more than 20 North American cities.
An invitation to an American Indian Forum in California is causing some Democratic presidential candidates to make some tough decisions. Jesse Russell reports.
Presidential contender Hillary Clinton has turned down an invitation to speak at a forum at the Morongo Casino Resort and Spa in California. The New York senator cited an ongoing labor dispute between the Morongo Band of Mission Indians, who run the casino, and Unite Here as the reason for not attending. The union has been seeking to organize workers at the casino, and they also oppose a deal that would expand the number of casinos in California because it would make it more difficult to organize workers, and the casino owners are already against unionization. Currently, only New Mexico Governor Bill Richardson and former Alaska Senator Mike Gravel have accepted the invitation that would bring tribal leaders from across the country to California.
AFACWA, the union representing Northwest Airlines flight attendants, is providing an average of $14,500 per flight attendant to help offset losses suffered by workers during Northwest Airlines bankruptcy. The money comes from the sale of a $182 million bankruptcy equity claim. The union is getting nearly 65 cents on the dollar for the claim. The proceeds will be given to the workers, 40% in cash and 60% as 401k contributions, within 2 to 3 weeks. Some Northwest Airlines workers will also get stock in the bankruptcy reorganization after the union sued and won a $65 million judgment, forcing the company to honor an agreement made with the workers in the 90s. The UAW has formed an ad hoc global auto sector organizing working group. In Detroit recently, the UAW met with unionists from Argentina, Brazil, France, Thailand, South Korea, Sweden, and the UK. The UAW says it must have a global strategy to raise workers' standards worldwide if gains made in the U.S. over decades of hard struggle are to be maintained. Southern Africa could be headed for a crippling metal industry strike. 270,000 employees could walk off the job if deadlocked negotiations between the employer and the trade union Solidarity don't improve on June 5th and 6th. The union has issued a statement that if negotiations are unsuccessful, then they will apply for a formal strike certificate. You've been listening to WIN, Workers Independent News. For more information, visit laborradio.org.
The difference between what I do on my show and what all the right-wing types do on their shows is very simple. I'm not going to lie to you. That doesn't mean you're going to agree with me about everything or that you're going to like hearing everything I have to say, but I will guarantee you that when I say something on my show, I say it because I mean it and I believe it, and I'm not just saying it to get you riled up and to boost my ratings. No potty mouth, no trash talking, no BS, just the straight truth as I see it, because the lies may sound good for a while, but the truth is there forever. It's not always pleasant, it's not always nice, sometimes it's hard to see through all the crap, but it's there. And that's what you're going to get from me, and that's why you should listen to my show. The Cup of Joe Radio Show, Mondays and Fridays from noon to 2 Eastern Standard Time on the Head On Radio Network.
As I understand the conflict right now between the president's bill and the one supported by the Democrats, John McCain and Lindsey Graham, is that John McCain and Lindsey Graham and the Democrats say that the bill, the standards we use, should be the standards that are the same as the treaty we signed, the Geneva Convention signed after World War II that every civilized nation follows. And the president is saying, that restricts me too much. That's too humane. I want to be able to do other things. I won't say what they are, but sources tell us that things like waterboarding, you know, drowning people, putting them in 50-degree weather. And the question, I think, is should we hold the United States to the same standards that England holds itself to, that Canada holds itself to, that other civilized nations hold themselves to?
Get the view from inside the Beltway with Mark Levine on the Radio Inside Scoop. Right here, 2 to 3 p.m. weekdays on the Head On Radio Network.
I'm trying to be less polite. I'm saying what I really think. The president's a fool. I don't want to get up early, and I wish I had a good sip drink. I'm trying to be less polite. I wanna call a spade. I wanna stop the war because I know the war will send too many children to an early grave. I'm trying to be less polite. get up early and I wish I had a good stiff drink. I
9 minutes before the hour, thank you for tolerating that little interlude. These things will happen from time to time, I suppose. And many thanks in particular to our IT consultant extraordinaire, Peter Godbold of Godbold Computer Services. You know, it felt a little bit like being on the ledge and being talked back into the room where you can't fall 40 stories. It really, really did. Bob is joining us from North Dakota. Let's go talk to Bob for a minute. Hey, Bob, welcome to the program. Bob? Hey, Bob. Bob. Oh, this is just going to be one of those nights, isn't it?
Hello?
Oh, there you are. Hey, Bob.
Sorry about that. I was doing a little chore here.
I understand.
Yes, I'm here.
I'm glad.
Goodness gracious. I have to apologize for last night.
Oh,
because
why?
I had an existential meltdown when I had that conversation with that little Ollie North wannabe.
not to worry, Bob. Not to worry.
Oh, but Glenda said, Bob, you were rather upset. And I said, yes, I was. But, you know, what I heard earlier this evening and listened to that our fellow traveler on this planet and what she had to read back to fill in for the, you know, the computer meltdown you had.
Yeah, that did it again just now.
Yeah. Well, I hope we're still hooked up.
Oh, yeah, we're still hooked up.
And,
just went down.
You know, I want to thank all of these wonderful human beings that are fighting and holding to the truth and listening to Head On and Nova M and all of the truth seekers out there. All of you, I respect you and I love you. Sometimes I argue with you and I ask myself, why are you so doggone argumentative? Because we gotta be, Bob. We gotta argue. We've gotta work this out. We've gotta fight to get it back. This nation, this thing that our founders hoped.
These two acts of bravery that we have witnessed in the last 2 days, Specialist Freeman and Private Donald. I've lost his name. It's not in my head now. The young man whose letter we read yesterday from Clarksville Online. These guys are heroes in my book. There's no telling what kind of risk they put themselves at by actually standing up and speaking truth. The one guy, Milo Freeman, who Ray Dean and I read this evening, that guy is still serving right now. He's in the sand.
You bet. You bet. And, you know, I am so proud of those young men for having that kind of courage. That is courage, Bob. That's the kind of courage that it finally took us to act upon in that awful place I was at to bring that one to an end. And now I am more than proud of these young men, but I am so angered by the inability of this sleeping nation, these sheeple, as our good friend from Air America puts it, the sheeple, you know, that they just don't want to know. And I address that with everyone that I meet, and I say, what is your problem? Do you want to remain willfully ignorant? I mean, ignorance can be cured. All you have to do is look for the truth, seek the truth, and then divine it. You know, decide. I mean, go in there and you be the decider. You can figure fact from fiction and everything that you listen to on the news, this national news, radio, or TV is just fiction. Now, if you want the facts, then you got to look for them. And if you do seek the truth, it will hit you between the eyes like a 2x4. And when it does, you will wake up and say, oh, my God, I've been asleep, and it's time for me to wake up. And that's all that it takes. It's not a national thing. It's an individual thing. Every one of us have to wake up.
Well, I think a lot of us are, Bob.
Oh, yeah.
It's the frustration kicks in terms of, okay, we're awake, we see it, we know the truth, we know what's going on, we understand. What the hell do we do about it?
Okay. When you address one of those individuals that are asleep and they keep saying and repeating those same Rush Limbaugh lines, call him a liar. Tell him Rush Limbaugh is a liar, and if you repeat what he says, you are a prevaricator?
Yeah.
You're one of repeating lies. You're a liar worse than the man that told the first lie. You are a liar. And, Bob, you're not a liar, and nor am I. I will not lie to you. I may, soft soap you sometimes and pat you on the back and say, hey, great job, guy. You did a wonderful job.
But yeah, we all need a little bit of that now.
We do need encouragement, but we also need a good kick in the pants to tell us to keep fighting. Like I heard today, it was like, okay, we ain't done yet. And that was on the Tom Hartman program where he was, you got this Bernie Sanders, and he's saying, don't quit now. You ain't ahead of the game yet. You're not even started into the, you're not even in the starter's gate. The only thing you are is you have a majority in the House and in the Senate. And it's a narrow.
Well, just out of curiosity, did Tom ask him about impeachment?
Impeachment. You cannot impeach if you don't have the votes to get it done. Now, the Republicans, they did it with Bill Clinton, but they did it so underhandedly. Now, we have to have a solid majority in both houses, and that means this.
Yeah, but see, Bob, I understand that thinking, but it really goes against the grain of everything that I believe. I mean, my values.
I know.
Because, to say we didn't have, they tried that BS on us with the first time they sent George Bush a bill that would have made him start bringing the troops home. He vetoed it. Okay, at that point in time, there was no onus whatsoever upon the majority in either the House or the Senate to introduce another damn bill. They did not have to introduce another damn bill. They could have put it on George Bush. They could have left it to him. He could have had to come back to them with his hat in his hand and say, okay, I'll do what you want. But they did not have the guts or the courage or the fortitude of any single one of the soldiers serving over there. They didn't have the guts or the fortitude of anybody listening to this program, because anybody listening to this program would have looked George Bush right in the eye and said, sucker, we sent you a bill.
Yeah, but Bob, we're talking about somebody that is bat. What is that Mike Malloy says? He says he's bat squeeze crazy.
Yeah,
this guy is beyond help. He needs. Then
that goes to what I said earlier. It's time to start thinking about that constitutional provision that speaks about the incapacity of the president.
Absolutely, and it's incapacity as a human being. This man has. He has no moral.
No, we've had those guys in office, though. I mean, he's no more or less moral than Richard Nixon was.
Yeah,
okay?
Absolutely. And
but this man is mentally ill.
Absolutely. This man, when they talk about Bush on the couch, I'd like to see him in a padded cell. I don't even want the man to have to go to The Hague and have to face war crimes. I want him to be in a padded cell with a very large quantity of authorizine drip. This man needs some real serious psychological help.
Yeah, better living through chemistry.
But it's hurting meeting on this same issue. It's not George Bush that we need to worry about. It really is the people of this nation have to take responsibility and accept their citizenship as something other than a God-given right.
Hey, Bob,
responsibility.
Bob, I appreciate it all. I'm going to cut you short because we're going to knock off for the evening. We're going to do news, and then I'm going to go to work on a computer.
Okay. Well, you have a wonderful weekend, and Glenda is doing great.
Wonderful. And for folks listening, it's not like we're going to go dark. We will replay the conversation with Joe Bajant from two nights ago. That might be something that folks would enjoy. So glad to know that Glenda's getting better. And you know, don't worry about getting upset on the air, Bob.
Okay.
Don't worry about it.
Well, sometimes I do, and sometimes
that's okay.
I'll do.
You take care, and everybody, my apologies, but we got stuff we got to fix.
Love you guys.
All right. Bye now.
Bye-bye.
News is next, and then, you guys have a wonderful weekend. I'm sorry. Take care.
This is the Quality News Network. One of President Bush's top aides, Dan Bartlett, has announced he's leaving his position. Bartlett said he's been thinking about leaving for several months because he wants to spend more time with his three children. He's one of the president's longest-serving aides. U.S. Attorney Tim Griffin has also said he's stepping down from his position as the top federal prosecutor in Arkansas. Griffin replaced one of the nine attorneys who were fired amid controversy last year. The Justice Department announced teams of federal agents will be dispatched to four cities that have had recent spikes in their crime rates. Mesa, Arizona, Orlando, Florida, San Bernardino, California, San Juan, Puerto Rico will get the anti-crime teams. The federal government has ordered drawings removed from the Internet of the U.S. Embassy compound being built in Baghdad. The U.S. architectural firm that posted the renderings of the $592 million facility has taken them down. Reporters Without Borders, an international media watchdog agency, is asking the Iraqi government for a police unit to investigate the targeting of media in Iraq. A record 13 journalists were killed in the country in May. On Capitol Hill, a Senate committee has called for an investigation into the interrogation and imprisonment of CIA terrorist suspects. In Venezuela, demonstrations continue across the country today protesting Hugo Chavez's takeover of the country's premier opposition television station. Over the past few days, one protester died as a result of violence as military troops tried to stop the demonstrators. One of the Serbs most wanted for war crimes during the Bosnian War has been flown to The Hague for trial. He'll be tried for his role in the massacre of more than 8,000 Muslims in Srebrenica. BBC reporter Alan Johnston, kidnapped 12 weeks ago in Gaza by Islamic militants, was shown on videotape for the first time today. There's no way to know, however, when that tape was recorded. The 31-year-old personal injury attorney who exposed hundreds of fellow air passengers to a deadly strain of tuberculosis says he's sorry. Now quarantined in Denver, Andrew Speaker also says his father taped the conversation with health officials telling his son he was not a risk to others. You're listening to the Quality News Network. We have science and business news coming up next.
Terry's Lounge at the Cypress Inn in downtown Carmel invites you to a great evening of your favorite foods, beverages, and live music Thursday through Saturday featuring Dick Whittington and friends from 6 to 9:30. Terry's Lounge in the Cypress Inn features an appetizer-sized menu and our famous burger, salad, and fries. Afternoon tea, a great local tradition, is served from 1 to 4 p.m. daily by reservation. Sunday evenings are special as Richard Divnick entertains from 5 to 8 p.m. with classical renditions of pop, jazz, and classical music. Join the fun, food, and music at Terry's Lounge in the Cypress Inn, corner of Lincoln and 7th. downtown Carmel.
Japan has threatened to drop its membership in the International Whaling Commission, that after nations once again voted to continue a 20-year ban on commercial whaling. Japanese fishermen kill approximately 1,000 whales annually. The meat is an expensive luxury found in Japan. U.S. hurricane forecasters characterized the 2007 Atlantic storm season as very active. Scientists predict 17 tropical storms, half of which will likely turn into full-fledged hurricanes. NASA announced repairs to the space shuttle have been completed and it will be launched next week. Golf ball-sized hail damaged the shuttle's exterior in February. The spacecraft will deliver equipment to the International Space Station. London's Heathrow Airport, the largest in the world, has got planning commission approval for a $3 billion expansion project. Work should be completed in time for the Olympic Games in 2012. U.S. payrolls increased by 150,000 in May. The unemployment rate remained the same, 4.5%. Wages also saw a minor increase. And a lawsuit has been filed against online dating service eHarmony for refusing to allow homosexuals on its site. Lightsweet crude is trading at $65.84, and Wall Street, at the close, the Dow ended up 40 points. There's more at QualityNewsNetwork.com. I'm Laurel.
Tech America, of which we are a proud part.
Yeah, I'm not ashamed of the name.
No. You know, we can fix broken cars and make 70-year-old houses work out just fine, and we're amazing folks, but we have been led astray, have we not?
Well, I think so. I mean, I think we've been manipulated politically. You know, it's not anything that new, except I do believe that the current administration and the last couple waves of Republicans understood a couple things. Like everybody says, oh, the Republicans were so organized at the grassroots level. You hear that from the liberals a lot. No, they had sense enough to collect church lists. Nobody had ever done that. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
That sort of thing.
It was a little sleazy, but, you know.
Yeah. Oh, a little. Voter caging and all that. But you know, I mean, my brother is a fundamentalist preacher over in Martinsburg, West Virginia. It's
oh, dear me.
Church over there. And I could tell by watching, they were flattered to get the political attention in the first place. In the second place, most people really didn't understand the separation between church and state.
Well, they're in that particular arena, they're frequently told that it doesn't exist, that it's a misnomer, that it's just a handy little phrase that was taken from a letter that Thomas Jefferson wrote regenerated by Hugo Black, and that, you know, no, this is not, it's not really real. There's no separation.
Yeah, I try not to, you know, in the book, what I tried to do is come meet my people and then see what you think, you know. And of course, you know, being who I am, I can't keep my mouth shut in between. I got some opinions, too.
Right.
But a lot of it, you know, somebody asked me the other day, you know, are working people doing anything to help America? I said, no, America's got to do something to help working people. They've been neglected, you know, and if you feel like they're ignorant or you feel like they're ill-informed, you know, then it's your America too, you know.
And there's a and I don't mean any elitism by this, Joe, but it's somewhere along the way somebody, and obviously you're doing it, we're trying to do it, has an obligation to try to get some of the information out there, to try to counter some of the ignorance, and it's not willful ignorance, whether it's the media or what's being passed down from the pulpit. There's a big con job going on, isn't there?
I think so, but there always has been. It's just been effective lately.
Yeah, but what, you know, whether it's we've had the discussions about immigration and things like that, and I pointed out at one point, you know, all these it's one thing to have an illegal, so-called illegal immigration problem in a state that borders Mexico, for instance.
Mm-hmm.
Why do you have an illegal immigration problem in North Carolina?
Or in my hometown, right here. The town proper itself is 26,000 people. We've got 4,000 illegal aliens live here, almost all from Mexico, El Salvador, and so on. And that's the way that people that run the high end of business and industry around here like it. It's no darned accident
No, and it has to do with, 10, 15 years ago?
Like my daddy's labor going down another dollar an hour if he were still alive.
Well, that's the truth,
Joe.
It's
never been lower here compared to buying power.
And, 15, 20 years ago, there were right-wing or Republican, so-called conservative legislators howling about something called right to work.
Yep. Well, now, I mean, my state's partly famous for the Byrd machine who invented the right-to-work law, Senator Harry Flood Byrd, you know.
Right.
And he actually started really early. We're looking at 30s and stuff, because he wanted the labor here cheap to pick apples. Here they grew a lot of apples then.
Yeah.
On what could only be called apple plantations. And if they could keep everybody begging for a job, then he made more money on his apple.
That's
and
darn straight.
His son was a senator. And I don't think political talent is necessarily hereditary, you know.
Yeah.
And they have, of course, the right to work law has just become so institutionalized now that.
And it's right to work in Virginia, in North Carolina, South Carolina, Georgia, Florida, Tennessee, everywhere that you see this influx of south of the border cheap labor, just curiously happens to be a place that has an entrenched right to work culture.
Well, absolutely. It's a sacred thing here, even working men. See, that was one of the earliest misnamings of a law, you know what I mean?
Yeah.
No child left behind and that sort of thing. But I was taking a friend here, he's from Russia, and he's American, but he's been in Russia quite a while teaching. And we drove down the street. I grew up here and partly over the West Virginia land on my grandparents' farm. We'd go back there every time my family would get too broke. And I drove down the street, and our town is 66% rentals now, all owned by about 12 people. It's a town with 10,000 residential buildings in it. And I drove down the street, two of the old streets we lived on, they were never good anyway. It was the place where white met black at the edges, you know, right mm-hmm. down the seam down through town. And the people living in those houses, of course, many of them are dead and so on, used to own those houses.
Not anymore.
They bought them working at the mill.
And,
you know, and sad. It's really sad.
Yeah, welcome to the Bush economic miracle.
That's right. That's right.
It's
an ownership society, but...
Well, we've had one of those before, Joe. We've had one of those before, and there was a little dust-up back in 1860 fought over the ownership society.
Yeah, that's... yeah. Well, it's a lack of information here. It's also, I've been around this country enough to see. My friend tells me it's now happening in Russia. But you know, the belief in here's these cheap Walmart goods. People feel like they're doing better than their daddy did, because they got some new cheap slave labor clothes made in China, and they got a new truck. There are two payments behind them.
That was assembled in Mexico.
Yeah, you know, and they say, oh, we're doing better. You know what? You know, because you got more debt than the last four generations of your family ever had. You know, no job security, no health care, and a few cheap trinkets and doodads and electronic junk. Well, the snow job worked pretty well.
Yeah, it's worked very well. What you know, the essay that you wrote prompted me to contact you was Redneck Liberation Theology.
All that, yeah.
And in which you describe, among other things, your neighbor down the, you know, the neighbor down the road, who thought he was doing okay, and everybody noticed the foreclosure notice published in the legal ad
yeah.
section of the newspaper, and you sort of, you know, oh gee, that's tough, and you don't say so much about it. But that's big. That's, you know, we're going from the American dream to the American nightmare. Are we not?
Pages of them these days of those boxes. Now, when I say, you know, I don't want. I always worry a little bit when people refer to the stuff I write from beliefs. A few years ago, well, I finally just started acting on it about 2 years ago. I'm 60 years old, you know, and I wanted to do better than I have done. I always joke and tell my wife, you know, I felt the devil's hairy hand around my ankle. I'm going to clean my act up and be a better world citizen. So I went down to Belize and found a village there. And for $3,000, you can build a man a home, you know. For $500, you can put a working woman in a restaurant business, you know. For $1,000, you can start a man in a construction company. These Garifuna people, they're black fishermen, and they're the underdogs of their nation. So I always try to make it clear, that I don't go down there to lay in the sun. You know, this fat old guy.
I don't think anybody could hold it against you.
The proceeds from the book are all go entirely there. I live on $4,000 a year because I'm trying to talk and walk my talk, you know, and it's possible.
Bless your heart for it. I admit I was reading the article and I put on a Jimmy Buffett song, but I don't think there's a crime in that.
Well, all I was saying is that you can go and make the world a better place. And everybody says, why didn't you go down to New Orleans? Because what goes down in New Orleans is a racket, and a man with $10,000 or $15,000 couldn't help America. You know, we can, but there's another way to do it. You know,
right.
It's political.
Right. But you know, but also while you were in Belize, Joe, I think you were able to put some. Oh boy, I'm going to sound like a real granola eater now. You put some psychic space between you and the stuff that you like to observe.
Well,
the stuff that matters.
A bit of granola. I'm an old hippie too.
Okay.
And I left this town. I joined the Navy right about my age. I was 15 and a half years old and went off to the Vietnam era just to get away. And I thought it was opportunity in my eyes, you know, but it was getting out of a small town. And when I got back, then I went through sort of a hippie stage, which I'm proud of. You know, I learned about a little bit about being free. I think we knew something back then that a lot of people don't know now. But it's made me on the left side of the political scale for the rest of my life.
Well, I don't see how it could help but, because you stepped to the outside and you looked back in, and I think you're continuing to do that. At least that's what I'm getting from the essays that you write. Even sitting there where you are,
I'm in Virginia right now.
Right, so that's what I mean. Even sitting there where you are, there's still a little aspect of, you know, you didn't get conned, you didn't get sucked in, you didn't buy the hokum, you didn't drink the Kool-Aid or rub the snake oil on.
I did for a while. I did for 15 years. See, I mean, I was a guy that quit high school, right, and got a GED in the Navy. And when I got out, by the time I was 20, I was married, and I had a 16-year-old wife, and by the time I was 21, I had a kid. And my first experience with college was to get the $210 a month on the GI Bill, and then the whole world opened up.
Yeah, and again, the GI Bill is not what it was.
No,
it's a come on. It's a carny. It's a carny's card trick now.
Oh, I know. Do you think Lindy Ingram was ever really going to go to college?
I know.
I don't know if you've hit that chapter yet where she talks. You know, but if you never had a book in your house growing up, you know, and your daddy was a truck driver and your mama was a waitress, and you spent your time watching American Idol, there, I don't care how much you're in the Army, you're not going to walk out of there and go to a university. Probably not. That's the odds. And the big lie that anybody can become president, not when you're in a white culture. My argument in the book is much of white culture is ghettoized, too.
We just don't prefer not.
The difference is we don't wear the baggy shorts and the bling and the chain around our neck. We got a truck and a gun. But it's the same ghettoization if you can't see outside the box that you're trapped in.
Yeah, and if the most you can hope for is to maybe tread water and stay even with mama and daddy, that's an abnegation of the American dream, isn't it, Joe?
Well, I think so. I mean, I think every American probably had a different dream, but there was some commonalities that appealed to the whole darn world, and one of them was owning your own home. That was a pretty darn hard thing to do in the 18th century when this country was founded. I mean, an idea of boundless land and some yeoman sense of freedom, which I personally believe a warrior, as the Scots-Irish are, they did understand that certain surly aspects of freedom, you know, that are very good. Jim Webb writes about it in his book, you know, those things are all gone. A man's home is his castle. My friend from Russia said, you know, in the city he lives in, 1 million people, every single person owns their home outright and has a DACA in the country, and they're bitching because they're not as rich as Americans.
They're watching too much TV, Joe.
Well, he said they don't get it, you know, that all this stuff has been taken away from working people who are at least 60% of the population, and I could make a good argument for 70%.
So let me ask then, Joe. This particular essay title, "Redneck Liberation Theology: Why Are Leftists So Damn Afraid of God?" This is our prayer meeting edition. Wednesday nights is prayer meeting here at Head On. So I have to ask you: do you see it as being part of any sort of liberal or progressive outreach to the working South? Does it have to clothe itself in the mantle of religion in similar fashion to what the right wing religion industry has already done?
Well, I don't think urban liberals. I mean, what we have going on. It's almost urban versus rural in its cosmology. My editor, my publicist, and I'm a redneck boy. I never thought I'd have a damn publicist. An editor. They all grew up, urbanites in New York, and they're strong liberals, and they're great Democrats. And I don't think they can do outreach. I don't think they understand us enough. I think we have to be, I'm doing a new one about trench liberals, and leftnecks. There's people that can come from our own people. I've sent in enough bars and churches around here to know that we got plenty of darn smart people that can speak the language,
Yeah.
And I personally have talked to hundreds and convinced them. Usually not, but over the years. And we're not incapable of getting the point. But I just don't think it's going to be like it used to be where, the person that has a certain kind of urban liberal education and background, it's not going to be able to say it the right way, And then when I say why are leftists afraid of God, that's more a symbolic way of saying it, Well, there is a spiritual self, and most of all, there's moral self. That's what my next book is about, and it's sort of about redneck liberation in a way, except it's about Americans starting to find the moral center they lost, I don't know what to say beyond that. I think mm-hmm. people should not be afraid of morality, and they should not be afraid of spirituality, and they should not be afraid of brotherhood. And those things are not the exclusive property of Jerry Falwell or Pat Robertson or the Republican Party.
No, we were talking, me and that mouse in my pocket. I was talking last night with a gentleman from Media Matters for America, and we sort of verged onto that topic insofar as we don't necessarily, that survey that was done after the 2004 presidential election, and the media made such a hoo-ha out of it, where people said, moral values were the reason that they voted for George Bush. Well, moral values are also whether or not your neighbor gets to keep his house, or whether the guy comes with the rollback in the middle of the night and takes away his truck because he can't make enough money to take care of his family. Those are moral issues as well. And I think you're absolutely right. I think there's a reason that John Kerry never had a prayer south
never,
of the Mason-Dixon
neither
line.
Neither is Hillary Clinton.
No, she doesn't.
But all the people up there at the publishing company are thinking, hey, well, Hillary's going to fix it all.
I don't see it because I don't see,
I said you couldn't have picked a more disliked woman in America by and large when it comes to voting.
Yeah, and that's not to say no woman can win.
No, not at all.
It's that woman can't win.
That woman can't win because she's perceived as ambitious, as cold. And they tell
let's
she's not.
Uppity.
Well, you better show people.
Yeah, let's not forget uppity, Joe. She's
uppity. Yeah.
That's
a good show.
Yeah. The same thing with John Kerry. He came to West Virginia, and we stood out in the hot sun at the airport in Beckley. And he came out and he talked to us about what America needs.
Yeah.
And a little bit later he showed up at a rally on Labor Day where the UMWA gave him a hunting rifle.
Yeah, I saw that.
And he was about as believable with that hunting rifle in his hand, whether or not he hunted every day of his life. It didn't work.
No,
it didn't speak.
I didn't want to vote for Fred Munster.
No.
He wasn't believable at all. But even beyond that, I don't really, I really don't much like, and I'm so far left, I got to send up smoke signals to say hello to the Communist Party. So I don't know what the hell you say, you know. But I don't like the easy explanations like framing and all that. But there is some truth. The culture wars, there ain't culture wars. It's just people, you know. And when the liberal, the educated liberal mind, and I guess I'm an educated liberal, sort of, you know. I'm incorrigible, but I tried. You know?
Yeah.
But the thing is they love the terminology. And so we hear about culture wars. Yes, you can define it that way. And that's nice. And it's nice for the university crowd to talk about. And when I read about it, I'm fascinated. But it's not going to say hello to your brothers down here.
No, and there's a... You can't be afraid, and see that's why I got in touch with you, Joe. I felt like you and I were resonating on the same at the same rate on the same string.
Brothers under the skin.
Exactly. You can't be afraid to walk into a bar, and you can't walk in there going, oh my God, they still allow smoking in this state. Oh,
right.
You can't be afraid to know a little bit of Bible, and it wouldn't hurt us.
At the same time, they talk about culture wars. They won't acknowledge that the Bible then is part of the American culture.
Sure, it is.
Have it both ways.
No, you're absolutely right. So, you know, I think it seems to me, Joe, that you are taking the fight where the fight's got to go, and that's a lot of what we're trying to do here. We've got a host on this network in Florida. We've got a host on this network two of us in West Virginia, and more growing all the time. And I get emails from people saying, "My God, it's so nice to hear somebody coming from the South who's talking liberal common sense." I think there's a place for it, Joe, and I think you're
especially
doing something
in West
really
Virginia.
Important.
You I'm getting more. Out of West Virginia. In fact, my oldest son, he's 39 years old, and he he grew up, you know, I moved around a lot when I was young, looking for work and stuff with the wife and kid, learning to be a writer and all that. He moved back, he moved over to West Virginia, and he's happy. He says, you know, you won't believe what's starting to happen in this state. You know, it's just somebody's got to say it out loud in the South, and he's right.
Yeah.
You know, and you got to reach some people, like you say, you know, with a media network of its own, and but he said it's here, you know.
And the biggest part of it is letting folks know that they're not alone.
Right.
Because one of the best tricks that the other side has done is to create this sense of the isolated liberal, as if we were some sort of endangered species like the snail darter.
Yeah. Well, you know, too. I always tell people. You know, when I'm dealing with people, you know, from northern urban areas or the West Coast, I lived out there for 14 years and I loved it. And it's a good place to live in most cases. And the average person from the West Coast in California is no more zany and kooky and spacey than the stereotypes, you know, that we have of New Yorkers, you know. I mean, most people there work pretty darn hard for a living. But the stereotyping has just gotten entirely out of hand. And I feel like we allowed the Republicans to own all the words like values. If anybody's got a claim to values, it's at least the first half of the Democratic Party's history.
Sure it is.
But we let them claim those
the
words.
The 40-hour work week. That's a human value, the 40-hour work week, because that enables things like family togetherness, family cohesiveness, the child labor laws, you know, yeah. We were responsible for that too, Joe.
But see, you know, they just claimed the word without defining it. And they say, why do the people go to church so much there? You know, church attendance now is no higher than it was in 1820. One third of Americans have always been pretty darn religious. You know how many born again presidents we've had? But the difference is that, to me, when I looked around at my hometown when I came back, is the institutions. When they looked around at the institutions, public and social and civic, what door was open to them? The church.
Sure.
They could take their kids. There was bingo night. There was camps. There was marriage counseling. You know, what community was left? The church. You know, and there they could be among their own kind of people. But one of the big lies is that they're homogenous. They're not homogeneous. You know, if I go to a big praise temple here, you got two or three guys that run it, and they're politically active. You got about eight or nine elders, the inner church, a friend of mine, a minister friend of mine calls it, that are activists. You got the front row that are the main fans. But you get back in that back third, and they haven't even been baptized.
No, they're there. They're there just to be reminded, I think, Joe, that they are not utterly isolated in this world.
And it's traditional. You see what I mean?
Yeah.
No, well, here's one good thing. It can't, and when you raise a kid, you have to expose them to the church. But if you sit back there and you get to know them, you find out that one-third of this great body of people that everybody is painting as being totally homogeneous is not at all homogeneous. You know?
Yeah.
And those are the guys you talk to.
Well, exactly.
Fred Clarkson, Clarkson wrote Eternal Hostility, and he was the first guy to start laying it out, you know, about this battle between that political battle that was coming up. And he said, the first thing you got to learn is who you can talk to, and that's that whole back half of the church.
Acrobaptist.
You know?
Yeah, I mean, I describe myself to the world as a recovering Southern Baptist. I know exactly what you're talking about there. I know those people, and I know, you know, what it's like to move into a town where you don't know anybody.
Yep.
Well, you know, there's an open door at the church. You know, you can't just move into the neighborhood and join the JCs or the Civitan.
Right.
But you can always you can find a church, because every one of them's got a welcome sinner sign sitting outside.
Well, and the other thing too is it's a community of working people. Everybody's been convinced that they're middle class, and really most of America is working class, but doesn't know it because they sell job instead of citizens. We're consumers now. And for instance, if the man tells you how many hours you'll work, what you'll get paid, what benefits you get, how much sick leave you get, if any, when you can take your vacation off, and when you can be let go because he doesn't need you anymore, that's called working class.
Yeah.
But the guy in the white technician's uniform down at the hospital doesn't see himself as working class.
No, he's a professional.
And the woman wearing the fake costume jewelry at some boutique that's making $8 an hour doesn't see herself as working class. And even medical technicians and people who went, you know, to some degree of training, I mean, they don't think they're working class because they don't have a blue denim shirt on and walking out of a mine wiping coal dust out of their eyes. Well, they got the world's changed. See, the traditional working class that people have in their mind, of course, it's a media image just like everything else. You know, those people walking down the hospital floor at night, they better start seeing they are, too. They're not middle class just because your car's shiny. You know?
Exactly. Exactly. Well, Joe, I tell you what, I've really enjoyed our conversation. I know you're going to get awful busy here in a very short period of time, but I hope maybe somewhere along the way you can find time to come back and we can chat some more.
Well, I would love to, because anything out of West Virginia that I'm a fan of, and excuse me if I rattle on.
No, I love the rattling, man.
I drank a little bit of coffee here. I said, I'm getting worked up for this one. We're talking in the great state of West Virginia.
Well, I tell you what, any time, I am serious, any time that... The burr gets under your saddle. Please consider that there's an open door and an open line for you here. I love the way you write. I love the way you think, and I think there's a whole lot there's a whole lot more that need to hear what you're saying. I hope they'll hear it in the upcoming book.
There's been some big surprises about that book because the reason I never wanted to even write a book. I mean, they called me, I didn't call them, and I'm not bragging, I'm just saying, I don't want to go through a divorce. I've watched a lot of writers do books.
Yeah.
And but the thing of it was, they said, oh, well, the market is the urban liberal. And
is this a travel log?
But you
from
know
the...
what? I get hundreds and hundreds of emails a week from people. You know, they might be school teachers, they might be supervisors at the plant, they might be this or that or the other, but the majority of emails I get are from people that do not have a college education. Only 20% of America gets a degree. And so, in their high and mighty judgments about who the audience is going to be, the big shock has been there's a hell of a lot of people that still know how to think in this country.
Sure.
So I've been absolutely deeply moved and humbled, you know, by the response that's come from, you know, people that are taking it up the shorts and say, yep, that's the truth.
And who have gotten their education the hard way.
And maybe got none at all. I mean, there's so many self-educated people in this country. There's no acknowledgement of it. I had no idea that there were so many literate people, educated themselves from working class families with a high school education.
Sure.
You know, and went on and read things and do things and think.
I wish
I could show you my emails.
I'd love to see them. There was a book that came out, I guess maybe a year or so ago, the title of which was Whistling Past Dixie. I don't know if you're familiar with it or not. But the thesis of it, Joe, is that in order to build a Democratic majority in this country, Democrats need to forget about Alabama and Virginia and North Carolina and Tennessee and Kentucky. Just forget about them because you know, that's high-hanging fruit and it's going to be too much work to do. If we're, and you know what, maybe he's right. If we're willing to just forego the notion of a republic and one nation under God and or you know, whatever you want to call it, if we're willing to forego that and just balkanize an entire segment of the country and cede that battleground to the other side and say that those people aren't worth it, then that guy's right. But if you're right and if I'm right, then that is where we take the fight.
Yeah. Yep. You know, I'll tell you another thing, too, and I don't want to drag it on too long here.
All the time these, you
these
want,
values,
Joe.
These values that these people hold at core, if somebody wants to get down and talk about values, and I've done it in some gritty darn venues, there are the things of a decent wage, you know, a decent opportunity in life, and so on. These values aren't just white and Scots-Irish. The reason the book's getting so much publicity is because nobody thought white people could be oppressed, right?
Mm-hmm.
The big liberal myth that the white man is always the oppressor. Well, I'll tell you, when I talked to these Hispanics, I organized a renters union, you know, because of what was going on here, no housing inspections, and all the things you get away with in the South. And I found out there, the thread of common basic values is common to working black men, working white men, and new immigrants. You know, a chance, an opportunity, and a little bit of justice and security.
And a willingness to work like a dog.
Yeah,
in exchange
for
a little bit of that.
That used to be the values of the Democratic Party, those three things. They could still have all those people, you know, before the Westchester Country Club decided it was better to get yuppies in 401Ks.
Yeah, there's so much truth in that. I was recently down in Alabama, Joe. That's where I was born and raised. All my family's from here. My dad passed away a few months ago, and I'm trying to handle his estate and take care of his place. Mm-hmm. And I went down there to look after a couple of things and pick up another truckload of stuff and bring it back. And within, 30, 45 minutes of having pulled into the driveway, two different neighbors had come up and said, you know, just wanted to let you know we're keeping an eye on the place while you're gone. And I can think of a lot of places in the United States where that wouldn't happen. There's a lot of places in the United States now, Joe, where you can live... you can live 50 feet from somebody for 25 years and never know who they are.
Yep.
The
whole big band around D.C. is like that. Now, I lived out in Eugene, Oregon, the same way. I lived 10 years in a house there. Met my neighbors on each side about four times.
Yeah. Before I left, the 93-year-old neighbor lady brought me a sweet potato pie. To have on the way home. She said, you know, I've seen you out there working so hard in the yard and cleaning up and everything. I wanted you to have something special. And by God, this wasn't wasn't a sweet potato pie in any Ritz pie crust either. This had been rolled out, had a little bit of fat in it, and had drops of ice cold water sprinkled in the flour, rolled out and put in a pan, and the filling put in it and baked for me. I got tears in my eyes.
I know you, brother. You do know the truth, don't you?
Those people, dadgummit, Joe, those people are worth fighting for.
Yes, absolutely.
And bless her heart, this particular neighbor lady wouldn't deign to set her foot in the same tracks that a Democrat had walked in, because she has been hammered by a singular message that we have no values, that we're godless, that we're atheists, that we're that we want to take the "In God We Trust" off the money.
And a real quick example of something.
Yeah.
That we know that, and I don't have a whole lot of faith that the Democratic Party is going to pull it out either, you know, but we are the liberalism is inclusiveness. If it's nothing else, it's inclusiveness. The divisiveness that has come with ethnic and identity issues and sexual preferences and gender issues and all that work against us when here it was an election year, and what did they make a big issue? Gay marriage. Jesus Christ, let us all get free first.
Well, let us.
I mean, what kind of choice? Who would have made a choice like that if you knew where America was?
Well, but we got conned on that one too, Joe, because that was
politically
that was a creature of the right. I mean, the memos are out there. You know, emphasize gay marriage, emphasize the big rocks in courthouses and stuff like that. We've done a lousy job of equating. Of letting them talk about gay rights when we should be talking about human rights.
Exactly, and wages, and what we're going to do when the oil runs out, you know?
Yeah.
It's kind of like my mother. I have an elderly mother in a nursing home, and she's from that, you know, that previous generation, and we were talking about stuff that was on TV, you know, about gay marriage, and she says, "Well, honey, I ain't quite sure what they do. Might not be healthy, though, huh?" You know, I mean, these are people who never even think about it, you know, but they wave it around like a bloody shirt. You know what I mean? She's never thought about gays in her life.
Never met a communist either, but, you know, there are people out there who are just sure that, you know, that people like you and me are trying to advocate for the workers' paradise.
No,
when we're not,
I'm saying a whole lot of bad stuff is coming down the road. The cheap oil fiesta is going to be over, you know. And then what are we going to do, man? If we're not pulling together now, what's going to happen? You know, when all this cheap energy, they think the price of gas is bad, you know. In Belize, it's $12 a gallon, but people don't. They ride bicycles and. It's like your sweet tater pie, you know. The neighbors, I go away. I don't own the house there. I built the place there, put it on somebody else's property, and said, "You rent it out, and if I come back," and I send them $100 a month, 12 months a year. Anyway, they look out for me, all my stuff. You know what I mean? My guitar and the things I've left down there. Nothing's going to happen. You know, they're neighbors. And that's what I'm trying to show in some of the next things that I'm writing. What real community felt like, and people like you and me, we still remember it.
And if we don't...
We may be the last generation if it keeps up.
It could very well be. And if we don't rebuild it, when those times come that you are talking about, Joe, there is going to be hell to pay.
Oh, I know.
You know, we've got to find our way back to where neighbors talk. You know, part of what we do here is dedicated... We call it, you know... And I think we earn our stripes. We call what we do here conversation radio. This isn't talk radio. This isn't host driven. This is about dialogue. It's about process. It's about discussion. It's about looking for answers. And it's about sitting on a front porch and talking amongst yourselves till you can, you know, because you can solve a lot of problems that way. It's not just idle chatter.
Yeah, and not a totally controlled conversation. Yeah.
Right.
I never thought I would be the fat old uncle sitting on the porch running my mouth this mad. I had an uncle had political opinions. Well, you know, I'm proud to be in his shadow, you know. And like you say, it is like a porch conversation. It can go where it goes. The person might be behemoth and it might be relaxed, you know, but it sure beats the silly managed promotion of most of this interview stuff.
No, you're going to be doing some of that.
I'm doing 200 basically scripted interviews.
Yeah, where I know I, where the you get the little sheet with the
yep.
book that says here are the questions to ask Joe.
And, well, I had to write the questions and the answers.
Oh God!
And then I had to dumb them down twice.
Oh Lordy, I tell you.
And I didn't want to do that.
Yeah.
You know, I signed a contract. I took a man's money, and so I did it.
Yeah, sure you did. Well,
but,
I want this to work out for you. I want the message to get out there. If there's anything we can do to help beyond encouraging people to buy the book and talk and know your neighbors, talk to the folks, start an American dialogue, because that seems to be where you're going to. If there's anything we can do to help, Joe, please consider
it. It's the same here.
A new friend.
Same here. If there's anything I can do. I mean, they tell me that, I tell you, I had a couple touching moments here this last month. You know, when Studs Terkel wrote that blazing endorsement for it to put on the cover,
yeah,
you know, about the voice of our people, I was sitting there at the computer with tears in my eyes, because there was a man who's described working in America all his life, and he was my hero. I mean, he's been my hero since I was 20 years old.
And Mark Crispin Miller comes out and says, you write like an avenging angel.
Yeah, well, you know, and you would understand. Each time something like that happens, I'm seriously choked up, because I never thought I would see something like this happen. And now Random House is putting it up for a National Book Award, you know.
Jiminy.
Yeah, I mean, that doesn't mean it'll win it, because I know what kinds of judges, but it doesn't matter. It's the idea of our journey from where we are, from where you are. I mean, it sounds like your background was much like mine.
Coal miners.
You know, to come so far in America has been a gift. I mean, it has been a gift. I worked for every damn inch of it. But can't throw it out. You can't throw out the opportunity. You know, the opportunity to be free and to speak and have dialogue, like you said, that porch, the American porch.
Well, you know, when somebody like Howard Zinn says that you evoke working class America like no one else, that would bring tears to my eyes.
It did. It did. You know, and Sherman Alexie, who wrote, he's not so popular out here, but he won a National Book Award. I lived on an Indian reservation in Idaho. I built a cabin and I plowed with horses. I wanted to just escape America, right? So I did this for about 7 years in northern Idaho. Sherman Alexie is a young, well, he's not so young, he's 50, but he felt young to me. And he lived up there on that reservation, and I didn't know it. And he wrote an endorsement for the book. And then he called me and he said, you know, I used to come in the bar you tended and drag my daddy out. You know, and I remember, oh my God. That's Mr. Alexie's son. And he said, it's the same America. It's the same America for Indians, and it's the same America for working poor white men. You know, he said, and he had been waiting for a white man, you know, to write about the oppression of working white people. And so once more, you know, I was so damn emotional. I mean, my God, this guy whose books I admire, you know, for telling the truth, books like Reservation Blues and Lone Ranger and Tonto Fist Fight in Heaven, and really did is he made it so soulfully real what reservation life was. And then to find out that you had helped him carry his daddy out many nights, see, I didn't remember because it was so many years ago.
Yeah, that.
So these kind of things that have come accompanied in it have just shocked you when you come from a town like this. You say, wow, what a large country, what a journey being an American can be.
What a large country, what a journey, and what a tiny, tiny place in many ways as well.
Yeah, oh yeah, and yet it's tight.
Well, I tell you what, we could go on like this for the rest of the night. You know, but I know you're busy, and I know you keep at it, and those 200 interviews you got coming up, man, that's going to take some starch. I mean, you'll have some saddle sores when you're done with that, Joe.
Across time zones.
But, you know, I love this idea of, what did I see here? Bourbon-fueled prose.
It's a long tradition.
White, hot, bourbon-fueled prose. I can't imagine anybody writing that about something that was written by one of those guys at the Westchester Country Club we were talking about.
Well, you know what? As Southerners, you know, we have a culture that came for an awful long time without any operas, without any movie, without any string quartets and all this, and telling a story was entertainment in a hell of a lot of cabins and plantation parlors. And your ability to tell a story, we have a story gene, you and me and just about anybody I've ever met in West Virginia, you know.
Yep.
Because social acceptance was part of it was based on a rural culture that you had to be able to tell a good story, and often you were your own victim in it for the humor's sake. So that's been a lucky gift, because coming from the South enables you to write, to tell a story, and instead of just report facts.
It's got to be interesting. You know, there's that old saying about the English came and built a house, the Germans came and built a barn, the Scots came and built a still. You know, these things fall into place. And again, I don't know how much of the urbane, sophisticated liberals actually understand that. You know, a trip to East Aboga, Alabama, is as mystifying as a trip to the Congo. And I don't mean any racial overtones to that. I mean,
nope.
It's every bit as foreign. And to have somebody offer you the bottle with the cork out, and no glass.
Yep. Yep.
Is some level of heresy. But if you sit back and you take a swig, Joe.
Yep.
And you start to talking and you feel that burn in your belly, and you hear the way that board creaks under the rocker of the chair.
That's right.
And you pick up the inherent rhythms and you start talking about the real problems that face real working people, then the next thing you know, it's gonna play a little bit more hollow the next time that guy with the perfectly manicured hands and the no hair out of place haircut comes on the TV and says, "I've got family values."
Right.
It's going to be a little harder to run the con.
John Edwards got $55,000 for a speech on poverty.
God. I know.
I mean, you know, it's, some of us can, you read a line like that, and how can that pass anybody? Those two words, that number and that word in the same sentence in a newspaper. And nobody was shooting him down.
Well, can I ask you one last hard question,
sure,
then, Joe? You mentioned John Edwards there, and we talked a little bit about Hillary. Do you have a person who is there a person on the Democratic side of what's going to happen in 2008 that has captured your fancy in any way?
Oh, yeah. Yeah, lots of them, but nobody ever heard of him. Jim Webb's the only one anybody ever heard of. Oh, man. A lot of people don't like him, you know. For a liberal, he's a little bit military, you know. Well, we come from a fighting line of people. And, you know, I told him I didn't like your book. I think he emphasized the fighting too much. We got a lot of other good stuff about us, you know.
Yeah.
And, you know, but, you know, we get along. And, but by golly, you know, when he understands the symbolism, you know, that wearing those boots, it's not just a stunt. He's got a son in Iraq. When a man tells the president off on television, you know, the guy says, "How's your son?" He'll be doing a lot better when you get us out of Iraq, you know?
Yeah.
I mean, the guy is, got that nice wild streak. I really like him. There's many things I don't know what he'd be like as the president. I know he wouldn't be the most stupid warlike president we had, but we're not going to get anybody that's going to have all the qualities.
Well,
compromise and agreement. But it's the first one I've ever seen. Him and a couple other people that are local ones, you know, that stand up and just say it.
Well, we're in a profound state of frustration here, the folks that share their time to hang out and listen to me prattle on, Joe. We're in a profound state of frustration because, you know, Hillary doesn't look like it. Bless his heart, Barack Obama doesn't look like it.
No.
You'd like to say maybe John Edwards, but again, you know, there's a lot of off-putting stuff there.
Yeah, see, the thing, too, with John Edwards, I mean, I'm really lucky that a lot of people, I'm only 85 miles from D.C. It was the sticks when I was growing up here, and now it's the way exurbs or something.
Yeah.
And so they tell me things, you know, I mean, people you know that are in the government and so on. And the thing is that John Edwards has the right roots, but is suckered in by some yuppie thing. They said if you meet his people, you know, you're going to meet some people with Bible hair.
He's been consulted, hadn't he?
But he's afraid for anybody to see it. And the other thing is, of course, he is a lawyer. That's two strikes right there.
Yeah.
Seriously, though, they said that the thing about John Edwards is that he's pretty much sucked into the Westchester Country Club thing when he doesn't have to be. That if he privately, you know, he does get it.
Well, I think he does. And the lawyering that he has done, Joe, to me indicates that he does.
Yeah, that's what I'm saying.
You know, the other side calls him an ambulance chaser. But, you know, when a guy takes a case on of a child who literally got sucked down a drain hole,
mm-hmm.
You know, that's a guy fighting on the side of the angels,
yeah,
as far as I'm concerned.
Say, and they say he's a... That the image stuff is to bowls him over too much, you know. Hell, look what it did to John Kerry when you let other people control your image.
Well, look what it did to Al Gore. I mean, here's a personal, a completely personable human being,
yes,
who got imaged to death in 2000.
Yeah.
And meanwhile, there's George Bush running around the country mispronouncing the entire language, and people think it's because he's a good old boy. It's not. It's because he's a moron.
I know. But, you know, just about anybody they got could sit on their hands, and if it, any Democrat, and get elected and sit on their hands and not do any more damage, and look pretty damn good to me.
Well, yeah, I get some of that. I just wonder.
I'm only half joking.
I understand what you're saying completely. You know, we've had Dennis Kucinich on this program, and why Dennis doesn't get more attention from the populist, from the people who have a populist turn, is beyond me. Because
he's my absolute favorite candidate. He's consistently is, and I don't know what to do about it.
You know? I don't either. I honestly, honest to God, I don't. There were better answers in the debate coming from him. I just about wept. I don't know if you watched that debate, that so-called debate, where they asked him, asked the rest of the field if anybody would join with him in his bill of impeachment against Dick Cheney, and all those hands just hung there by their sides, and Hillary looked at the moderator like, well, you know, if looks could kill, the poor dude would have gone away in a basket. It was grieving. It was grievous to see that happen, Joe, because that means that there's an entire field of political candidates on the Democratic side who are more obsessed with their quest for personal power than any sort of dedication to
a class. They are a political class, the same as the old Communist Party had a political class. There's one party in America, and it's called the Party of Business, and it has two sides, the Democrat side of the coin and the Republican side of the coin.
So do you just sit it out, Joe?
No, I don't think so, but what are you going to do? You know, I mean, you got to slap some people around, I guess. You know, I just don't know. I mean, because they've sold out. The Democrats, you know, all we're offered is two parties, you know, and you know, it's edged closer and closer to a more and more conservative values. I don't know. I mean, if Kucinich is possible, I'll write him in.
Yeah.
But, John Edwards is not a bad man.
No, and everybody's sort of sitting back saying, you know, well, Al Gore could do it.
Al Gore could do it with one hand behind him.
Because I think he's learned the lessons of the handlers. There's not going to, you know, Bob Shrum is not going to run his campaign.
Good.
And speaking of books, that guy's got one.
Well, Jim Webb darn near didn't win in Virginia, and you know, this state is getting more and more liberal as people move down from up north. And I had a friend, he's the head of the Green Party here. Well, people are quite surprised to know there are Christian Greens, mm-hmm. You know? They care about the environment, they're Christians, and they're green. And we got them here, and they've got them in other states, too. Well, everybody was kind of shocked. But anyway, when it came down to the wire, and for the last couple weeks, there was Webb and his Republican opponent, you know, 1 point apart, weeks on end, and the Greens had 2.5% of the vote.
Yeah.
And we always joke about how the Greens, you know, save Jim Webb. I mean, it's a story you'll never read about. Midnight conversations, and Jim saying, "I can't even do anything with these guys that handle me and all this," you know. But finally, it comes down to be one of our better victories here had to do with a bunch of unknown Christian Greens. And of course, when that candidate threw their vote to Jim Webb, they lost 1.5%, but all they needed was that 1%.
That was enough to take it over the top.
These are stories that you're not. Why don't we hear about this in the news?
I think it goes back to what you said, Joe. This is about managing what working stiffs get to hear, because you know they've maybe got 30 minutes, an hour tops a night over the over dinner with corporate over-the-air news coming at them.
Yep.
God knows they might be watching Fox, at which point you just go, well, Jesus, it's over.
I don't think they watch as much news as everybody says either.
Probably not.
I don't
Sports
know anybody
Center.
That watches Fox News in roughly around here, unless there's a big thing going on, you know, something big. And I go, well, I wonder how much of this is smoke and mirrors. Well, I mean, Fox, it offers a lot of things that people in my class like, but at the same time, I was trying to think up and down the streets and down the block there. I don't know anybody goes home and watches Fox News, right?
No, not at all.
I'm wondering how much smoke and mirrors is going on there.
Well, you know, we've talked about ending the war, Joe, and I've put out there time after time after time that, you know, we can have a million people in Washington, D.C. on a Saturday yelling in unison, end the war now, and they're all gone on Sunday.
Mm-hmm.
And as long as that persists, it doesn't matter if you've got 10 million people there on Saturday. If they're gone on Sunday, it don't matter. And
well, you know, when the women had their big national thing there about a year and a half ago or whatever, it had 250,000 women came to town. You know what the Washington Post had about it? They had a story about the traffic jam it caused.
Not surprising. And the point that I keep trying to make out of this, Joe, is that guys, you know, the guy who earns his living changing oil down at the Jiffy Lube might be able, and he's politically astute or whatever. He's part of that group of Americans that you so reverence. He may be able to show up in D.C. for a demonstration on a Saturday. But if he stays there till
maybe, I mean, I live close to D.C. If I went, the first demonstration I ever went to was as soon as I got the heck out of the Navy, I started going to demonstrations against the Vietnam War. And I don't know if they work anymore down there. I mean, you could have the whole world turn up in D.C. And it's had so many, and it's so immune, and it's with its free speech zones, and it's all this stuff. And you can get a permit. If you don't get any news coverage, it doesn't mean much.
And there's not going to be any coverage unless they're there Saturday, Sunday, Monday. But again, the dude who changes oil for a living
campaign. They sat there for months on the mall until somebody had to pay attention.
But we live in the MasterCard culture now, Joe. And if you're not back at work on Monday, you're going to lose the house.
Yep.
You're going to lose the expensive jewjaws of your existence that somehow define your sense of what you described earlier as thinking that you're middle class.
Well, what it is a combination mall and gulag.
Yeah, you're absolutely right. And
you know, I'll tell you, I do believe, and because most people, even, you know, I mean, both sides of the, you know, the average Republican's not as different as the average working man, as people think. You know, he's misled, even the traditional one, you know, but we have a lot more in common than we think. You know what would really hurt?
What's that?
Somebody didn't pay taxes for one day.
Well,
the whole house of cards would come down if there was even 2% of the United States that says, no more, I'm not paying any more for any of it. And now that sounds pretty radical, and it sounds like you could never organize it, but it's going to be very interesting how people express their anger when we do hit things like peak oil.
And when we're no longer able to do the Walmart shopping because every last decent job is gone from this country, it's not going to be a tax revolt. It's going to be a tax necessity.
Hey, I heard a terrifying thing from an economist the other day about globalization. I couldn't believe it. He said when Henry Ford invented, you know, the motor car, he needed his workers as customers to buy.
Yeah.
So he gave them a raise. So he could sell at least that many thousands of them by the time it was over, and millions. He said, and so workers were necessary as consumers. He said, the polarization of wealth has now so far reached the tipping point that the wealthy around the world, I mean, this is not the wealthiest. We don't have the most wealthy people, by the way. I mean, they're all over the planet, and they leverage capital from the capital cities and the banking centers of the world. Constitute enough of a market that you don't really, at some point, you probably won't need the Walmarts and you won't need the Radio Shacks or anything like that, because when you have that much money, you know, polarized at that end in 5, 10, 15% of the world that can pay $300,000 for a car, the advantage is you don't have to make as many, you don't have to ship it as far, you don't have to do as much production. That leaves everybody else working darn cheap. You know, because they're not even necessary as consumers anymore. And I work down in a third world country where they sell them water to drink, you know.
Yeah.
And, you know, basics of life in many, many ways, you know. And it can come to it in this country, you know, where the basics will be what you're struggling for instead of the symbols.
Yeah, where you're making.
It can happen. I mean, I said, how can this be? How can a small group of people have so much money that they constitute the entire market, and therefore you don't need the millions to buy anything. And he was showing me, it's if all the money is there, that's where you do it. I had no idea. I had no idea that this polarization is global.
Oh, when Halliburton packs up bag and baggage and heads for Dubai, you know the fix is in.
Yeah. I mean, you know... nobody ever heard, you know, I mean, the wealthiest men in the world, you know, they have Mexican names, they have Arab names, they have African names, and French and German and all that.
And they all have one thing
really
in common.
I'm aware that the elite, this thing is not just here, it's everywhere.
No, but they all have one thing in common, Joe. They don't give a tinker's damn about the guy who's busting his ass 6-7 days a week at one or two or three jobs.
They don't even see the guy.
No, he doesn't exist. She doesn't exist to them.
Right.
Because it's not like they're going to go into a truck stop or pull into that Jiffy Lube. They've got an entire separate layer of people who will go and do that for them.
Right. Two or three layers.
Yeah, that's the truth. And we're talking there about a servant class.
I'll tell you what. I wonder. You line in candidates up and you say, how many of you know what Jiffy Lube? You know,
yeah, it's
ever been in one.
Yeah, it's
I'd say John Edwards might be the only one.
it's Pappy Bush at the grocery store in 1992.
Yeah.
What's this barcode scanner thingy? My, isn't this curious?
Isn't this wonderful? He goes, you know, and I've read something by Paul Krassner was writing about it at the time. He says, is it any wonder the Japs are beating us? I don't mean that racially.
No, no.
You know, you got a leader who doesn't even know what a scanner is, and we're heading into the age where computer domination of everything, and this is our president.
And the guy who's running the country now probably doesn't know what a gallon of gasoline is going for.
Oh, I'm sure he doesn't. You know?
Yeah.
Well, I mean, somebody was telling me.
But it's not just him.
Offered, there's like a 8,000 gallon storage tank or something.
Yeah, there's a bunch of people who don't know what the price of gasoline is in the United States. Most of them are in the Congress.
Yeah, that's the truth. You ever lived around D.C.? Man, it is an education. Man, I watched when they built the Rayburn Building. I'm so old I can remember that. And that was really gonna, you know, they really needed a lot of expansion. The Senate office building was too old and decrepit and all this. So they had all these offices, hundreds of offices, and they had bronze doors. And the bronze doors had eagles, and they had the history of the United States on it, right? And somebody complained that the louvers at the bottom that let the air in, people might hear the conversation, and they melted down all those bronze doors. And that was then.
Yeah.
And I'm looking at now, up the street, there's a guy that's a multimillionaire because he builds heliports, you know, on private estates out here of big Republican contributors, right? And all this is paid for with Homeland Security money because it's supposed to be the Continuation of Government Act. And so they go in and they build them long, historic-looking buildings that will sleep 24 people in galley kitchens, pay them $4,000 a month for maintenance, put in special communications, high-speed cables like we don't even have. Well, these guys were the big backers. And so the continuation of government thing is basically if there was ever a war or a national disaster or a terrorist event, they would disperse the government and send them out to these places. And all it was payback, you know, for the big cat, the big cat contributors. Now, the crazy thing about it is this guy became a millionaire simply by being a contractor because they had a big meeting in Crystal City. And they invited all these guys who had been faithful supporters. And they went into the contracting business, and they're still spending Homeland Security money out there making big.
Oh, there's a boatload of new millionaires out of the bungled Katrina recovery alone.
Yeah, well, you see how they paid them back? They made their estates bigger and fancier and richer.
Yeah, exactly. And meanwhile, we sit around and we I'll be damned if canned corn's done gone up again.
I have told people about that, and they go, they're unmoved, and I go, they say, well, you know, government's all crooked.
Hasn't that been the message out of the Republican Party, Joe, for the last, 40 years? That government, I saw a quote from Tom DeLay in an article today. I mentioned it earlier on the air before our conversation, where he was talking about Newt Gingrich, and he said, government is the problem. You know, we have been through a history, Joe, where government was responsive to the needs of the people, where government was a solution, government was a way out, government was a way up, government was an equalizer, And in the short period of time that the people like Grover Norquist have had the public's ear, he's managed, and largely because, again, going back to the origin of this conversation, we have seeded the debate. The Grover Norquists of the world have succeeded in telling America, teaching America to hate the government that belongs to them.
Exactly. Well, you know, the thing too is, see, there is an anti authority streak in Americans, and we can thank the Scots Irish for that too. They're not the only ones. They carry the gene, you know, when they'd marry anything that walked. I mean, their values went everywhere, and God love them. I'm glad we have it, the surly love of freedom. But the dislike of authority is a very, very American thing. It's down there in the bottom of people that you just wouldn't even believe it's there. It's not at the Westchester Country Club, but it's a distrust of authority. And Norquist knew how to use that. And those Reagan guys, you know, big government, you know.
We were going to get government off your back.
Communist-like thing, you know. And that plays well.
And it gets, it's easy, too, Joe, because it gets absorbed, it gets passed around. And government is far away, and the news about government's usually not good. And so it's easier to look at, oh well, government's my problem. It's not the fact that I've got a right to work law here that is making me auction my labor off in a downward sleazy downward spiral race to the bottom. That's not the problem. It's government.
To do it.
Yeah. It
did you see that thing in Harper's about they had the nerve to take on the question of what if we became a totalist state? What if the military took over Washington, D.C.? Did you see that issue?
No, I didn't.
Well, they bought in some great retired Pentagon generals. They bought in some great old retired senators and media people. And they said, well, you know, it's a big, sprawling country. And for most people, if tanks went down the street in Washington, D.C. tomorrow and the Pentagon took over, you know, the government, for most people, it would be something that happened on television in D.C. Now, I know that they were joking a little bit, but that's the truth. That's the disconnect. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
They'd see it, and some people would be outraged, and of course, we'd be out there. We'd probably be armed by then. But the point of it was that government isn't real until election time to 99% of the people. You know, you and I happen to be particularly vocal and particularly active, but for most people, government is something that happens on television.
And it's something that happens on television to the point of nausea, so that by the time Election Day rolls around, we've had so many 30-second attack ads that we just want it to be over, and we'll just stay home, turn the TV off, it'll just end.
Yeah, a fellow too the other day, I thought it was pretty observant. He was a German guy, and he said, "Well, from what I see, I don't think see how anybody would see any direct result of their vote on their lives."
Yeah.
I thought that was interesting because he could observe that. It's just, you know, you don't see things being done for people very directly and obviously by the government like you do in certain other countries that are more socialized.
You see, it's a deliberate attempt, Joe, to keep government from being responsive. You know, we were preached the sermon about how government is the problem and government can't accomplish anything and it all has to be done by the private sector and government will fail no matter what it does. And bang, Katrina hits. And look, government failed, just like they told us it would.
Yeah, because they live in an isolated consumerhood.
Yeah, and because they meant for it to fail. You know, look at the privatization of our military.
Oh, I know.
What, 50,000 gun-toting so-called private contractors? You know, come on, Joe, they're mercenaries, okay?
And that's just the ones carrying guns.
Right.
Not the ones doing a $100 bag of laundry.
And a five-star general can stand there and scream himself blue in the face at one of those mercenaries, and the mercenary can thumb his nose at him and tell him to bugger off.
Oh, I know. Well, you know, I saw something in Italy. I went to a Communist Party rally in Italy a while back, and because I was working for a magazine where I had to travel, they had international editions, and so my wife and I, in our 50s for the first time, got to go and see the world, you know, to the degree that business travel as an editor would let me do. And so they're in election time in Italy, and so I went to all three parties. Their elections only last a couple of weeks, and so they have these big rallies for each one. And I went to the Communist Party rally, which was a bunch of young people, right, mostly.
Mm-hmm.
And so I got to know this guy. When they have a problem, when they, you know, with the street or the house or paying a bill or something, you know what they do? They go down to their party headquarters, whether it's a Democratic Christian Party or whatever, and a very direct thing happens. You know,
the problem gets solved.
The government and their party directly. Now, screwed up as we might think some of those countries are, that just knocked me out.
You know, see, I don't think it's screwed up, Joe, that when the French bus drivers go on strike, the French school teachers go on strike, and when the school teachers go on strike, you get, I mean, all the way down to the local magistracies, the magistrate won't show up. I don't think that's crazy. I don't think that's bad. I think that's a perfectly rational response for working people to an intractable situation. But we've got laws in this country that say that one union sympathy striking in support of another union is a violation of federal law, and the union reps can go to prison for it.
I didn't know that. Really?
Yes.
My God, where? How can solidarity ever be achieved?
That's kind of the point.
What blew me away is they walk into the darn party headquarters. It's the same thing in belief, you know, the two, well now three parties, that in the small towns, and we don't have very many people down there, you know. Mm-hmm. And there's, you know, the office of the party, and you walk in there and you say, you know, my end of town floods every time it rains because they haven't come down there and graded it. And by golly, a grader will get out there. It's their government as crooked as ours. But a man can walk in and talk to the government.
And there's so much to be said for that. You know, we talk about this Employees' Free Choice Act. It's a card check agreement. And the idea being that if you want to organize a workplace, you pass out cards, and if 50% plus .00001 say, yeah, I want to be in the union, you got a union shop. And the right wing is having an absolute purple polka-dotted blue screaming hissy over this. They're having kittens with crocheted tails, and they're screaming that, well, it's anti-democratic. They're taking the secret ballot away from working people. What they're taking away is the ability of the management to haul the workers in and basically psychologically kneecap them before these dummied-up, ginned-up, bogus elections can take place.
I tried to organize a newspaper in this town years ago when I came back and made another stab at living here and trying to make some change. And, of course, you know, the owner of the paper's daddy was Harry Floodberg, or his granddaddy was. And the tactics were just incredible. So we would meet, because the reporters were the more over-educated persons, but by God, there were pressmen down there on the line and said, yep, it's been too long, you get to your 19th year, you're ready to retire, and somehow you get cut loose. And the retirement fund, it turns out the owner's children benefit from it. Nobody ever retired from there. This was now made illegal. Anyway, so we're trying to organize a union. They sent guys out to come and copy everybody's license number at night and stand out there and look menacing. You know what I mean?
Oh, yeah.
And this went on.
And it means something.
On and on, and you couldn't believe it. Finally, an atmosphere of terror did prevail. Just through millions of little actions.
Bet I know how the vote went down.
Yep. Yep. It wasn't even close.
No.
Because in the end, the more educated reporters voted for it, the blacks voted for it, and the rest of them were scared for their jobs.
Well, not too awfully long back, within the last year or so. You remember when the transit workers went on strike in New York City?
Mm-hmm.
The head of that local went to jail over it. Because the transit workers in New York City, liberal New York City, Joe, do not have the right to withhold their labor. Now, when you don't have the right to withhold your labor, we're generally talking about a scenario that happened before 1860 and south of New York City a good bit. But it's the same thing.
You're still talking about human bondage in a way, different kind.
If you cannot withhold your labor, you're darn right. And meanwhile, you know, maybe some people think we're piling on. At roughly the same time, Hillary was showing up at the groundbreaking ceremony of the new Goldman Sachs building.
Yeah.
Where millions of dollars in corporate welfare had been doled out.
Getting caught being on the Walmart board. You know?
Yeah.
You know, I mean, you know, my editor edited his books, right? You know, and so she's a big Obama fan and a typical New Yorker, and that's fine. God, we love each other. We have fought and had tears and arguments over getting this book and getting it right and what I want to say and what the world doesn't believe or whatever. And I said, look, this guy, graduated from Yale, or Harvard. So did his dad. You know, this guy's trying to pass for black. Nothing wrong with him. He's got a good heart. He's got all these things that you guys
love
would like to see. The only thing that would be better is if he was a woman. But the fact of the matter is, he's rich. You know?
Yeah.
He declared $950,000 income last year. You know, he's a child of diplomats. And if he can mention a guy in Africa that's father to happen to go to Harvard, I mean, this stuff, you know, that image, they believe in this holographic kind of politics.
Yeah, don't, well, you know, just don't show up at Dreamland in Tuscaloosa and expect me to think that, no. No, just because you show up at a barbecue joint or something like that does not make you a man of the people.
Right.
And I say that to white or black, either one.
Well, they're talking about electing a black. I said, man, first of all, he's going to have to convince blacks he's black. All my black friends, they go, you know, the Democrats, they tend to own the black vote, at least in areas I've lived. And but we all sit around and laugh. You know, it's like, this is a little rich boy. He's still going to do better than any damn Republican candidate that they ever put up. But it's the idea, let's get an ordinary man. What happened to the Jacksonian, you know, tradition?
Well, there's Dennis Kucinich again, okay?
There he is again.
You know, Dennis Kucinich still has his union card, Joe.
Oh, right.
He pays his dues. There were months on end in his life as a very young man when he lived in a car. And I guess that's the 20th century equivalent of growing up in a log cabin.
That's a nice way to put it. I may have to steal that leg, brother.
Hey, you know, consider it a gift, okay?
Okay.
He's been involved in government since he was 26 years old.
Oh, I know. I remember the stories about him when he was mayor. I remember an article called Dennis, the Menacing Mayor of Cleveland.
Mm-hmm. And
at about owning the utilities.
Yeah, and at the age
of, to be good.
At less than 30, he stood up to the humongous banking interests who held the paper on the city of Cleveland and they said, give us the municipal power and light company and you won't go bankrupt. And he said, screw it. Bankrupt us. We're hanging on to the power company. And they've still got it.
And aren't they glad?
Yeah, and they're very glad. And yet, if Dennis Kucinich can get any press, the first thing you hear usually is the man who bankrupted Cleveland.
Oh, I know.
Jumping Jehoshaphat, Joe. I mean, this is back when the river caught fire.
You know, I was living in Eugene, Oregon, for a while, and they have a strong old wobbly tradition.
Mm-hmm.
The old workers of the world, the woodsmen of the world, the workers of the world, and they own their own utilities company. Just because that happened a long time ago, and they refused to privatize. And my God, you know, your utility bills, all of it together, is $30 a month. There you go.
Yeah. So yeah, but you know, obviously, it's clearly a failure because it's not participating in the stock market dynamic.
No.
Couldn't resist the voice. I apologize.
And you check because they sold some of the juice.
Yeah. You know, we spent a bunch of public dollars here in the holler. To put in what in the country, you know the phrase, city water.
Uh-huh.
And that thing hadn't dripped out its first few gallons before the thing was put on the block and bought by West Virginia American Water, owned by American Water, owned by a British holding consortium, which is ultimately owned by a German outfit with the worst environmental record in all of Germany.
They're buying all the water in the world. The world might be 95% water, but only 2.5% of it's fresh water. And only 1% of it flows because the rest of it is frozen. And these guys are so smart. I'm watching it all over Latin America. You know, politically, they put in their own guys. They let the wells get really dirty and not taken care of. They let them become unsafe. And the Crystal Water Company is the devil on hooks. It's everywhere. And pretty soon the truck comes down the street and a man is spending a quarter of his monthly income to buy fresh water for his babies. And this is happening all over the world. Africa, Haiti, the Caribbean, South America. I mean, we got a problem anyway.
Can you
imagine the privatization of water?
They're working on the privatization of air.
Really?
I'm not kidding.
You're not kidding.
Insofar as you've got the sweetheart deals that get passed for the coal companies. and the power companies allowing them to pollute. And the, I mean, what are these pollution credits where you trade from point A to point B if it's not the privatization of whose air gets polluted?
Yeah, right. Exactly. What else is a pollution credit? Now I get you.
So, you know, I don't know what the answer is, Joe, and I don't know that anybody does. But a damn good starting place is getting working folks to realize, you know, to look at each other and realize they're working folks. I go back to the grand old tradition of the UMWA, the first fully integrated from the get go labor union, because everybody was black down in that hole, and they were black coming out. And so that union was integrated, and the first thing that those early organizers, God rest her soul, Mary Harris Jones, the first thing that they tried to teach those miners, and it was Hungarians, and it was Italians, and it was Southern blacks brought up from the coal fields in Alabama, and it was old Scots Irish who had their land stolen from them from the railroad company so that they were forced into indentured servitude in the hole. And the first thing they did was get them together and explain to them, let me make it clear, there's no black people here, there's no hunkies and no dagos. There's no wasps, there's no mix, there's workers.
It's like you said, they're all black when they come out of the mine.
Yeah, and once they got them to understand that there was only one class, working people, then they began to have a chance.
Well, I'll tell you, the last chapter in the book is called The American Hologram, and it's about Americans living in a self-referential media world of where television and media and distraction tells us about gleaming eagles and church spires and our boys in Iraq and all this. And it's almost the level of distraction and saturation makes it really hard to get a message through. But Malcolm X was right about something. He said, first you must educate the people. And I really believe that any permanent change is going to come from informing the people like she did. You get down there, and you got to get the truth to them, and you're going to have to be somebody they trust or at least speak their language face-to-face, and that's what I try to get in the book. You're going to have to be there on the barroom floor, and you're going to have to be downtown. You're going to have to help the guy that's got the plumber's butt crack, that's got the three dislocated disc that lays your carpet, you know?
Yeah.
You know, if you believe this stuff, you got to do it. Otherwise, you're too damn comfortable.
And have some level of identification. You're not better than the guy laying the carpet.
No, because I'll tell you, you'll soon be laying it.
Yeah.
There's starting to be a proletarianization of the college educated classes, because there's a classism there. There's the Ivy League schools, and then there are this lower level that most of us will get our access to, the state university system that turns out the empire school teachers and all this and teaches them to indoctrinate, you know, working class people, you know, in things that just aren't true. And so, with, you know,
there's a reason that civics got pulled from the high school curriculum long about the time that I was graduating in the early 80s. Because nobody wanted to take civics. I took my ninth grade civics in summer school after eighth grade and got it out of the way. But I still had to take it, and I still had to learn a little bit about the structure of government.
Mm-hmm.
It was gone shortly after I graduated.
Isn't that amazing?
If you can take that away, you talk about the self-referential media world. In Ray Bradbury's Fahrenheit 451. See, Michael Moore did that to me. Fahrenheit 451. You remember the fireman's wife lives
been a long time, brother.
Yeah, lives in a house where there are giant television screens on all four walls.
Oh yeah.
And by virtue of computer communication, the dialogue in the TV shows that she watches include her name.
Mm-hmm.
And she can't understand why anybody would want to leave that group of people, leave that room, because they had become more real for her than she was herself. She could not be her without the media giving her her own point of reference.
And that's exactly what I'm talking about in the last chapter. You know, you won't recognize the Matrix when you're in it.
Mm-mm.
You know, because we all get up in the morning and feel the same way in the same world, in the same consensual reality. But the difference is that we didn't give our consent.
Exactly.
We just agree, okay, this is the way the world works. We don't know why we agree the way. I mean, they don't have civics class, so the average high school graduate has no idea how the government works. About a quarter of the people don't know the difference between the House and the Senate. Isn't that something? A quarter of the people that voted.
Well, and then there's the, I mean, by the time you do the math, Joe, the quarter of the people that voted don't know the difference. You know, they might have voted for a guy for the Senate and thought he was going to the, it doesn't matter. He's my congressman. But beyond that, then you do the math of the people who sat at home. So if, say, the 2004 primary here in my county in West Virginia, the primary, the nominating process, the most, you know, I preach that the important election is the primary. Because by the time you get to the general election, you are then officially in the wrestling match. And you're choosing between the guy in the red trunks with the red mask or the guy in the blue trunks with the blue mask. And one of them's going to win this year, but the thing's rigged, and the other one will win next.
You know, when the heaviest fundamentalists started loading the primaries and staying so late that everybody wanted to go home? Remember that?
Yeah.
This all started back with the Gingrich and the Reagan and all that early when they started rolling the machine.
Exactly.
Are liberals so comfortable and distracted that they can't do that too?
Well, and that's the point. The 2004 primary in Fayette County, 30% of the registered voters showed up. That means that 15% of the registered voters chose the leadership for this county.
Uh-huh.
And that 15% is actually a subset of an even tinier subset of the entire population of the county. And it happens county by county by county by county. And it's people, and you go to the polls, and it's routinely a generation that's ahead of yours and ahead of mine.
Mm-hmm.
These are folks. You know, my father passed away in February. He would not miss an election,
mm-hmm.
because he had had kamikazes try to kill him in the middle of the South
right.
Pacific, and he was by God going to show up. And the poll workers are 65 and 70 and 75 years old. My generation, the 40 somethings, you know. Maybe we'll show up. We're not going to show up for the primary. We're only going to go to the big wrestling match. We're not going to go to the one down to Little Armor.
You know, and for most people, it's a televised popularity contest. It's bad enough that we elected a movie star. Someone once told me, I think you people will eventually elect Mickey Mouse. Well, I think we already have.
I think we elected Goofy.
Televised popularity contest. It means that your state is controlling your political consciousness. That hit me. This happened years ago. It hit me like a ton of bricks. Like, absolutely, that's it. You know, the media is our engagement with political knowledge. Therefore, the result of the process is not going to be through any actual engagement with reality, but rather, you know, the signal.
It's going to be through engagement with the wrestling match.
Yeah, but look who's wrestling. They're all rich. The poorest guy makes $950,000 a year.
Yeah, and they've got an agreement. You know, I think Joe,
that might not be spoken, but they do.
Well, for me, the rubber mask came off at Christmas after the 2004 election when I realized that now Arnold Schwarzenegger showed up at the Republican National Convention in September of 2004. And in reference to John Kerry, said, "Don't be economic girly men." Okay?
Yeah.
Christmas dinner after the 2004 election, after John Kerry refused to take the $40 million that he still had in his war chest and fight and contest the Ohio results, after all that had happened, he and Teresa flew to Sun Valley, Idaho, and sat down and broke bread at Christmas dinner with the man who called him a girly man.
Yes,
they had dinner with Arnold Schwarzenegger, and at that point in time, I felt like I had just peeked behind the temporary curtains that are erected around the wrestling ring, and I saw them all sitting back there drinking gin and tonic and talking about who was going to win the tag team match next week.
Like the Romans.
Yeah.
And it's to them, it's a sport.
Only problem is, for us, it's a blood sport, Joe.
Right. But power is the sport of the rich, you know, and always has been.
Why can't they just go back to horse racing?
I don't know. I wish. I wish.
I don't know. It's enough to make you think we'd be better off with a monarchy sometimes. You know, so just wander off and be happy, raise dogs and race horses. And,
well, you know, that's it. That's me. It's dogs and kids. And when I go down to Belize, my soul is eased for a few months. I get to do something. I get to watch that an ordinary man can step out and do something and make a family's life better. Or do, you know, here everything is so indirect and so complex and full of agencies and laws and taxes, and you can't do anything direct. And so it gives me a whole lot of energy. This next book is probably going to be about liberation theology, but I'm not going to use any religious language, and I'm not going to use any political language. Do you know who Will Campbell is?
Yes.
Okay, so I'm going to spend some time with Will Campbell, and I am really looking forward to it, because I'm going to talk to some of the people who have been the fighters for labor with our people, and some of the people who have been theologians. And for those who are listening who don't know Will Campbell, you know, grew up son of a moonshiner. He led those four little black kids up those steps. He was a Baptist minister, you know, born fairly illiterate, and ended up being the dean of Harvard Divinity School. Lives in the log cabin, lives back there in Juliet, Tennessee, and is totally against the religious takeover. Won't step foot in half the Baptist churches in America, and he was head of the Baptist convention for many years.
Next time you drop him a line, see if you can entice him into a conversation here.
I will. You know, I'm so looking forward to this. People that during the 60s, people that came to hide from the world, came to his house, included Martin Luther King, Thomas Merton. And so what I'm trying to do is I've been talking to people that have real morals, you know, that and regardless of religion, you know, and look at these things about America, about labor, and about I think there's some spiritual questions to be asked here, and I don't care what religion you're talking about.
I think labor is a spiritual undertaking, Joe.
It is.
I mean,
so I'm working toward that. In the meantime, I'm hoping, you know, that this book, the message goes out, and anybody that buys it, you can be assured, my friend, that the money is going to help some real people. It's not.
Well, let me ask you about the Belize angle, if I may, please.
Mm-hmm.
One, what made it Belize for you as opposed to Costa Rica or any other small country? Two,
English speaking.
Okay, see, that's what I guessed, because I have these, you know, I'm not trying to, you know, get up on the cross or anything, Joe.
No.
But 5 nights a week for 3 hours, I'm here behind this microphone, and it seems like I live in this toxic swamp of bad news. And there are times that I talk about just bugging the hell out.
Mm-hmm.
And Belize is always where I wind up looking at on my Google Earth program.
Yeah, you can't get away from it. It's there too.
So,
but it's not in control. And poverty is opportunity. It's not opportunity because you go get to be the big white wanna, but because you can put food in a baby's mouth. You can give someone a way to make a living. You can live where the air is absolutely clear there because of the narrowness of it and the way the Caribbean blows. And you can look at communities that are absolutely still intact.
Well, is there? Let me just ask you. After this conversation, Joe, I hope it's okay for me to say this. I feel like I've known you forever. This is just a wonderful exchange. Let me ask you this: a place like Belize, is there room for a guy who's dangerous with a hammer and a nail in his hand?
Well, it's pretty interesting because I live among a minority there, the Garifuna people.
Mm-hmm.
They were a shipload of Nigerian slaves in 1566 that wrecked in a storm there, and they went ashore. And they built their own culture. They married the Carib Indians, an extinct kind that was here when Columbus came, but it's no longer here. But their African culture stayed intact. They're called the World Heritage Culture now, and they're trying to protect it by the UN. And I had been down there several times, but then when I found these people who live tribally, I mean, you know, there's microwaves and TVs and stuff, but, you know, there's also grass huts, and most houses are just little board things. You don't have any interior walls because it's hot, man. You're trying to get air to blow through this thing at night.
And somehow you don't need your Giorgio Armani tuxedo down there with you, do you?
Hey, I got to tell you a good George Bush story. His ambassador he sent down to Belize City, which is a great rotting old colonial city, you know, where all the races mix and all the cultures. So the first thing the guy does is he has a big formal dinner for the 100 most important Belizeans. I mean, there's ain't any rich people. There's some rich people. Yeah, that's true. There are. Anyway, only 35, and it was you had to wear a coat and tie. Only 35 people showed up because there were only 35 coats and ties to be borrowed.
Oh Lord! You're doing a bad thing to me, Joe. You're really pouring fuel into the bug out machine.
Well, you can't escape though. I mean, their government's corrupt too. The DEA has a big heavy hand down there. Most people have been very much colonialized. I fell in love with the Garifuna because they may have been. They're a little bit brainwashed by television, but you know what? We watch Al Jazeera and we watch Cuban stations at night, and we see different viewpoints.
Well, now, I mean, obviously, you know, you're wired into the electronic revolution and everything. You were penning columns from down there.
Mm-hmm.
What kind of technological infrastructure is there? I mean,
there's one internet cafe. This is a village of 1,000 people. Stretched over 2 miles because a fishing village would have, you know, one hut, the boat in front, and off to sea you go, all of you together. It's got a dozen gringos or whatever there now, and a little bit of tourism, but it's a dirty third world place, you know. That's not where most people want to go yet. And we got about 8 cars, 4 of which are running at any time.
The other 4 of which are for parts.
Everywhere you go. If you need to go to get they don't have prescriptions. My doctor is Juan Castro put there, and she is good. But if I want to go to the gringo doctor, there's one from Southern California, and she's very good. A doctor's visit is $7 by law.
Chivany.
And if I need anything, I have to get on the bus, and I have to pay $1. It's 2 Belizean dollars to 1 American, and ride 37 miles to get anything. But all things being equal, I consider it just about the right level to live in the world. And their community is totally intact. It operates. There's an anthropologist who was born there, and so he explains a lot of things to me. You think people are gossiping, but what it is communication about who needs food, whose baby needs to do this. And it isn't that primitive. I mean, hell, I can do anything. Anyway, they have an internet cafe. They have cable TV because all it takes is a dish and a wire down the middle of the street. So the Belizean government put these in for communications everywhere. So a German guy opened an internet cafe, and I go there because I want to support it. I want to see him. So he has a certain amount of bandwidth. He has 12 computers. The surf sloshes on your feet because it's also... what we call the meat locker, where there's 12 computers in there to keep the salt water, the air, from eating them up.
Yeah.
And it's a huge thatched hut, maybe 30 feet across, 40 feet across, and in the middle is a bar, open air. And you can sit there with your computer if you want, and at high tide, let the water run across your feet. Or you can lay in a hammock by the sea.
My lovely wife is halfway out the door, Joe.
But, you know, there's a downside.
I'm sure there is.
It's not dirt cheap like people think. You got to live like they live. You got to like rice and beans. You got to like fish.
Others may simply live.
Huh?
Live simply so that others may simply live.
Well, I'll tell you, I got down there, when I saw how they did rice and beans and so on, I said, "Hell, that's southern cooking, man."
Well, you say rice and beans, and you're not telling me I'm stepping down the culinary ladder because I had rice and beans for lunch today.
Pig's tails, the rich people eat.
Yeah.
When you go to, they don't have a frozen food industry or anything like that, but it's getting there fast in the cities. We have what we call the Chinaman store that's bringing entirely too many processed foods in. But most people are still too poor to do it. But
now, I want something wrapped in a banana leaf and steamed.
Poor. Or this isn't people stumbling around sick.
No.
These are simple people in the sun, children of the sea.
How just out of curiosity, is there an elderly Garifuna population?
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
I mean, folks get old there?
Yeah. Their society, they practice two religions. There's the Catholic Church, which all the schools there are run by churches because the government never had enough money once they got independence in the early 70s, I think it was, late 60s. The churches run the school. The government funds the school. So they got the Catholic Church, which is big in their society, but then their own religion called Dugu, which they bought from Africa. And it's a religion where you're in constant touch with your ancestors for advice. And they have these long thatched temples and churches. I don't even know. I don't go in there. I'm a white man. I respect whatever they do. And all night drumming. And it turns out, they tell me that actually speaking in tongues in the Pentecostal church came from the African slaves. I didn't know that.
Not surprised.
And it's speaking in tongues. Communicating with the ancestors. They also, a lot of them, even the young people, their culture is very intact because their language is intact. You know, but yeah. They speak perfect English. I mean, and they know what law and order is on television. It's complicated.
I'm guessing you don't have to lock up the guitar when you walk out the hut.
No, definitely not, because your houses are so close together. You wish there was a little more privacy.
Mm-hmm.
Kids come jump into bed with me at dawn, you know. It's like, school's out. And, you know, so I'm old, fat, white Uncle Joe. And, you know, we'll go over to the Chinaman's store and we'll get a jar of orange juice, you know. We got fruit trees in the yard and all this stuff. But, you know, here's the country that raises oranges right in their district. The poor man can't afford a glass of juice.
God almighty.
Because the American companies own it.
Oh, let's all sing the national anthem, Joe. It was freezing my butt off, and it was that particular Jimmy Buffett tune I was listening to the other day. I read your first article where he sings, "They're freezing up in Buffalo, stuck in their cars, and I'm lying here neath the sun and the stars." Oh, the name of the tune's Manana. But no, it's not all easy. But
now the children get tapeworm. The dogs kill each other in the yard. It's the world, man.
It's a brutal place. The world is a brutal place.
Yeah, and you know, they're very peaceful, loving people. You don't see any violence. I mean, you know, there's no violence. When you only kind of got 1,000 people, you don't steal anything from anybody, man.
Whoa.
You don't dare, because the worst thing that can happen is you'll be shunned by the village. We had a kid, 19 years old, kicked a guy in the knee and took his chicken dinner, and he was shunned by the village. And
his life got real bad real fast.
He slept on my porch for days. He'd come in late at night, lay in the hammock, and get up in the morning before I left. It was a community. Well, I think all of us, it was very odd because over the last couple of years, I've been welcomed into an extended family, and I feel so strange about being an elder because I'm 60 years old. I go, come on, I can't be that damn old. You know? but I am allowed to participate, you know, because I mean, I help the kids get to school, I help fix dinners and things like that. But when I saw what it meant when you're excommunicated from that community that's been sitting there for 200 years or whatever, it's very, very serious thing, and it holds people together
as it should be.
They drift around in the evenings. You'll see a couple families drifting along, and they'll stop in a house for about 15 minutes at 6 o'clock, say, and the next house. Well, that's the family that doesn't have anything to eat tonight. That's very gracious.
And they get something to
eat.
And
then next week, it might be the house you're sitting at. So these are all things that evolved over 1,000 years. You know, these little practices. The anthropologist has shown me this is the matrix of community.
And, the thing that impresses me, Joe, is it sounds like you've taken some of that and you've bothered to wonder, which is a huge step. You've bothered to wonder if that can be restored here.
Yeah, it's. I don't know. I don't know because I never saw it intact before. I've only seen it once before, and that was down with the Mayan Indians. But the language barriers and the cultural barriers were so great, I didn't know what I was looking at. I was up the Mopan River, where they still practice Mopan agriculture, and you see 500 Mayan huts, the smoke coming through the roof. They don't do chimneys, dogs, children, you know, Mopan corn. And it was too hard to penetrate. I knew that what I was seeing there was a living organic community of man. But the Garifuna, they speak Garifuna, and they speak English, and they speak pidgin English. And so the English part of it enables me to start to get a grasp on how they relate to each other and how they love one another. And like I don't have any grandchildren. So I just love it when the kids come up there at night. We pop popcorn and watch television. You know? I mean, it sounds like a dumb thing, but
no, it doesn't.
Movies, hell.
You're reminding me very much, Joe. I had we've got a good friend of the program, a young man by the name of Jeff Biggers, wrote a brilliant book that you might, I don't know, next trip take it with you.
I don't know why.
The name of the book is The United States of Appalachia. I think you would find it incredibly gratifying to read. But he also wrote one recently. It was a labor of love called In the Sierra Madre.
Mm.
And it's an experience.
Is it the Hispanic version of the Appalachians?
It is exactly that.
Yep, because I've been down through the Sangre de Cristo and saw the same thing.
His sojourns with the Rarámuri people. And he describes situations that are circumstances that are very similar to what you're describing. The work, you know, communal work parties, they make something there called Tesquino.
Mm-hmm.
It is a corn-based beer.
Mm-hmm.
And they'll get drunkard lords building fences, roofing homes, and, you know, the Tesquino party comes to your house next week and does whatever you need done.
God, I love it. It's not quite that organized there, but what'll happen is somebody will walk by and see somebody's... Well, like on my place, Eldon, the young man that did the work, I don't have the health anymore. I've got some pretty bad health problems. And coming down the street, sand road, would climb up there and help him for a half hour. Just because, hey, guy needs a hand, you know.
Yeah. And, well, you know, you still see a good bit of that here in West Virginia, here in the hills. And it's one of the things that...
I think there's a large element here, but one of the things... And it's going to be going on too late, so I'm going to have to get off of here. But
one
of the things is, it's very hard for an American to get it that they do not value a job. People say, the Garifuna are so lazy. The Garifuna don't want a job. They have about a 70% unemployment in our village. There's resorts at each end. The people that work there make about... $40 a week, well, a dollar and a quarter an hour, whatever that would come to. About a dollar and a quarter an hour.
Mm-hmm.
And they're trapped. They're slaves. You know, it's a different kind of slavery. But the average, a lot of young men and a lot of older men, they've been fishermen all their lives. They do not value a job. Well, the white people say, they're so damn lazy.
You know,
they get up every day and they do what it takes to make their world go round. And then they're done.
Yeah, instead of a job, they've got a life.
A mango tree, and we sip a little bitters, and they talk about life. One day there, and then I'll shut up, but you've hit something that's dear to my heart. I was sitting with a bunch of the older people. There's no age thing there, you know, but I was sitting with them, and I started telling about global warming. Now, these old men, they can sail by the stars. You know, they sailed the big 40-foot dugouts when a man to buy so much as a fish hook had to go to sea, you know,
mm-hmm.
for a day and a night, because there were no roads to the village up until recently. And I started telling about global warming, and they started crying because they had seen the dead reefs, and they knew that it was a true thing. And I was so goddamn sorry I ever said it. You know what I mean?
Yeah, I do.
I mean, it you know
there's the man who's dying, and there's the man who knows he's dying.
Yes, and I should never have opened my stupid gringo mouth about how it's all working, because they knew it was the truth. They've seen it, but they didn't need to hear the explanation.
Jesus.
You know, so that's how, you know, you go and you pollute an environment. You know what I mean?
Yeah, I do. And Joe, on that, we'll wrap. I hope you don't mind the amount of time I've taken from this.
Oh, no, not at all.
This has been talking to
Ken.
This has been one of the most glorious conversations I've had in doing this, and I've been doing this since 2003.
Well, let's do more. Is there a capability to call in?
Oh, absolutely. Anytime.
We can do that. You know, I mean, this is...
Tell your friends and neighbors. I mean, like I said, we're not kidding when we say we're trying to foster dialogue and discussion here.
I think it's a great thing, man. I mean, let's do it.
All right.
You know, there's two or three. I mean, you know, there's a network going on out there, isn't there?
Yeah, there is.
Yep.
And there's a hunger. There is a hunger. Because, you know, at the same time that you and I have been talking, I've been watching a small army of people in our chat room who are discussing what we're discussing among themselves. This is interactivity on a level that terrestrial radio and satellite radio can never even dream of approaching.
Exactly.
And privately and individually, there are email, as you and I speak, there are emails flying back and forth, people carrying on private message conversations on... there is more hope for dialogue, and I'm not trying to toot my own trumpet. I'm talking about the medium as opposed to me. There's more hope here for an American connectedness than there is in any amount of Viacom-owned CBS or GE-owned NBC or Disney-owned ABC.
Well, that's what I always say. You know, they may have their great media hologram, but we can build one too.
And I've been told to inform you that you are oh so welcome to drop by the chat room.
Oh, well, tell me how.
HeadOnRadioNetwork.com and just click chat room and register and you're there.
Yeah, well, now I might not do it tonight because I've been a little sick lately, but you know, I'm not a great internet cruiser and everything, but I like straight ahead talk with people in things like the chat rooms and the bulletin boards. You know.
Well, I think you might enjoy this, Joe.
No, I don't bullshit people. I'll do it.
Yeah.
Anybody can phone me. People don't believe that I really answer all my own email and I take phone calls. And the reason we have people here at our house is it's like-minded people have been coming through here for 2 years now.
Mm-hmm.
You know, from the Brokeback Carpet layer with 9 bad discs to Jimmy Carter's speechwriter. It's been like a miracle, and it's all the internet. You know,
yeah.
So anybody can write me at joebagent@joebagent.com.
My apologies on the mispronunciation.
They can call me, you know, because because it makes my world better too, man.
And that's the same thing that happens for me. I mean, I sit here for 3 hours a night, and I guess a lot of people who do what I do it ego driven. I'm humbled by this, Joe.
Yes, me too. Me too. Well, I think something's going on that, you know, I meet a lot of young people, and some of them suspect that something great was going on in the 60s, and they've been told a big lie about what was going on. Something wonderful was afoot, hope. And we never doubted that we were going to be able to make everything all right. So the big lie has been, oh, well, they were young and they were stupid. Well, what came out of it was everything from the health food movement to all kinds of things. And my own children felt cheated, you know, because in their generation they felt like nothing happening. This is happening. This is it.
Yeah.
You know, this cyber thing, this other architecture of information, architecture of the heart, communication. I know America when I'm seeing it. You know, I've seen one or two in my life, and this is it. I mean,
well, come on back and participate in the miracle anytime you want to, Joe. I consider you a friend, and I consider an honor to have a conversation of this depth and this extent and this length.
It's mutual, man. I'll tell you, I don't look forward to radio things, but please, anybody, you go ahead. I answer all my emails. I mean, there's hundreds of them, and if somebody's picking at me, no, I won't tell you that. Mm-hmm. But you know, we have an open door, open heart policy here.
Well, thank you very kindly, and I wish you the very best, and have a wonderful night. Great strength to you as you go through the book tour, and please stay in touch.
Okay, well, you take care, my friend, and you say hello, and I'll get in that chat room. Probably not right now, though. I'm going to have to go rest a little while.
That's fine. Any old time.
But I will. And drop me an email with any further information about connecting with people there.
Oh, I sure will. I sure will. I'll give you the whole schedule and everything.
Okay.
All right?
You take care.
You take care, Joe. Thank you again.
Okay. Bye-bye.
Bye. Wow. I feel like I've been doused in ice-cold fresh water, don't you? That's it for the show. We've got to wrap it up right now. No credits, no nothing. Just one thing. RMR. Gina. It's all for you.
You're listening to The Horn, the head-on radio network.
This is the Quality News Network. Beneath a barrage of bombs and bullets, the Lebanese army stormed the Nara al-Bared Palestinian refugee camp north of Tripoli this afternoon and overtook the al-Qaeda-inspired militants they've been fighting for the past 2 weeks. The fierce battle killed 19 people today, three of them soldiers. Many of the terrorists fled deeper into the settlement, taking innocent civilians with them to use as human shields. The Sunnis that prior to this week were fighting the U.S. and coalition forces have switched alliances and have linked up with the Americans to fight against al-Qaeda in Iraq. They've switched sides because they've become angered over al-Qaeda attacks on civilians and tribal leaders. U.S. commanders see promise in the recent development and will leverage the change in peace talks. In the past 24 hours, U.S.-led forces killed six terrorists and arrested 18 al-Qaeda in Iraq members. U.S. Defense Secretary Robert Gates is looking beyond the U.S. troop surge to a mutually agreed-upon mission of long-term deployment of U.S. and coalition forces in Iraq, much like the troop station in South Korea. Some of the ideas that might be implemented were outlined in the recommendations drawn up by the Baker-Hamilton Commission. Greek officials say the American attorney who exposed fellow airline passengers to tuberculosis while traveling to his wedding did not actually get married. Andrew Speaker didn't have the required paperwork, so the wedding never happened. Speaker set off an international health scare and is now quarantined in Denver, Colorado. A videotape of BBC reporter Alan Johnston, kidnapped 12 weeks ago in Gaza, was shown on a website operated by the Islamic militants who abducted him. Today, the date of the recording is not known. South Korea has offered a donation of hundreds of thousands of dollars worth of rice to North Korea in exchange for nuclear disarmament. North Korea is refusing. Free speech protests continue across Venezuela, opposing President Hugo Chavez's takeover of the country's premier television station. The State Department has issued a travel advisory to Americans as the Venezuelan